This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Pop, welcome to what very well could be the first, the debut episode in something that we are going to refer to as the Place to Be Nation Sports Network. What this is going to be is a series of pretty much unedited sports podcasts that we're going to throw out to you as random one-offs here and there. My name, of course, is Nick Duke. I will be kind of your football correspondent. I'll be coming to you throughout the football season to cover a variety of topics as we work our way from here, where we are in mid-August, all the way through the Super Bowl in February, maybe even some draft content after that. But we've come here today to bring you the official Place to Be Nation college football preview. Now, I know that Place to Be Nation is a group of individuals that has what my good friend Greg Phillips and I have often referred to as a Northeastern bias. But here in the South, college football is king. And there is no sport about which I am more passionate. And so for that occasion, I decided to reach out to a couple of guys who share my passion, beginning with the aforementioned Greg Phillips. Greg, how are you tonight?
I'm reveling in the fact that it's you, finally, you that has to shepherd a podcast while I am merely aboard the ship.
Well, so, one day we'll have you as a guest on the Marvel Age podcast, and you'll get to experience it on the comic side as well.
Oh, very good, very good. And yes, I was going to say Nick will be reporting to all of you wonderful listeners throughout the college football system whenever he's sober.
Whenever he's sober, which admittedly will be rare. But we are not alone. The hard-traveling fanboys are not alone here tonight because we reached out to another of our SEC brethren, our longtime close personal internet friend, Mr. Andrew Reich. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm glad to be part of the Place to Be Nation pop. Sports college
network. We're gonna kill you with names here.
But you have to remember that the motto of this network is that it just means more.
It just means more, much like it does in the SEC.
You know that woman that does for the uninitiated. There's the SEC conference commercials where the lady says it just means more, and it's like inundated for all SEC conference games, and people constantly laugh at it. You know that woman just gets bombarded with, like, hate tweets and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I feel bad for her. Yeah, especially with the current Urban Meyer controversy. I know there were a few signs I saw at the pro-Urban Meyer rally the other day that were taking shots at the SEC and the whole it just mean more thing and all that stuff, which I'm sure we'll delve into Urban Meyer here.
Us SEC folk are not done with Urban.
No.
For those of you who have to know, you know, I'm still convinced that Nick and Greg just brought me along for so that they could laugh at me since they played for the national title and we were losing the – me at LSU. We were losing to Ian Book in Notre Dame.
Well, you know, we will not speak of the national title except to say Tyler Simmons was on sides forever and ever. But that is neither here nor there.
Oh, my goodness gracious. They cheese with that whine.
I would suggest that if it were the New England Patriots, you would be whining the exact same way. Because, Greg, as CM Punk once told John Cena, you are what you have grown to become what you hate. You are.
We're not here
Patriots.
To talk about the NFL, Nick. We're here to talk about college football, which is in the South is king. And I would argue, Nick, that one team above all others is the king of college football. Would you agree?
I would agree with that. Absolutely.
And that
I would
team
agree with
is
that.
The BYU Cougars.
The BYU Cougars. Actually, you know what?
That's I was gonna guess Middle Tennessee State.
Oh, and you know, both
you
of
take
you guys
your Middle Tennessee State. I'm sorry. We're gonna keep this professional.
You gotta remember, Greg and I are both Troy alumni, and so when we were in college there, Troy's Student Government Association.
As an LSU fan last year, I definitely know where Troy is now.
What you may not know, however, is that when Troy moved to D1 and joined the Sun Belt, they didn't have any natural rivalries. So the Student Government Association literally just made one up with Middle Tennessee, where they created a trophy out of nowhere and just decided it was going to be a rivalry.
Yeah, so,
battle for the Palladium.
Yes, the battle for the Palladium.
Is Rick Stoskel, is he still there?
I don't think so. Actually, he may be. You know, now that I think about it,
he's
Rick
just
Stockstill.
One of those ones that just never went away.
Yeah,
you know? But I'll remember this because. LSU like got tripped up by Troy this time, but they had a couple close calls with them in the past, and I remember
when Nick and I were students.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one year they played them and they almost beat them, and it was actually a year where Saban was still coaching LSU, and I might be misremembering this, but I think Sean Merriman and DeMarcus Ware played at Troy.
No, not
Merriman, but DeMarcus Ware, OCU Manure.
DeMarcus Ware and OCU Manure.
OCU Manure.
Yeah, well, Ware or Manure played on the team that almost beat LSU in 04. And that was Saban last
Ware.
Year.
And
yeah,
see, 04 isn't even the close call I remember the most. The one I remember is
the 2018.
The 2008, when they were playing at LSU, and I think the score was like 31-10. Going into the fourth quarter, Troy
– Jared Lee threw a pick six in that game.
Yeah, and Troy was holding like a 21-point lead, and LSU outscored him 31-0 in the fourth quarter, and Troy lost 41-31.
Yeah. That game still haunts Neil Brown to this day.
I don't blame him. I don't blame
him. Well, I mean, first have to know, Greg got – like he had his cake and he ate it too because he's like a Troy – he works for Troy.
Yes.
Troy had like one of their best seasons ever.
Yep.
Under Neil Brown, they went 11-2, and Alabama won the national championship against an SEC team for the championship.
Yep,
it wasn't bad.
Greg has had an unprecedented run of good college football luck, but you know, we were talking about Troy here, and I guess let's go ahead, and we're just going to kind of take you guys through conference by conference, at least in terms of the Power Five. But real quick at the top of the show, since we're talking about Troy, why don't we just give some thoughts on the Group of Five? And obviously we're not going to go too in-depth here because none of us, I think, are qualified to break down, you know, Louisiana Lafayette's roster or anything like that.
But I can't.
Is anybody – I mean, do you guys look at it and see any other team that's really a bona fide New Year's Six contender other than Central Florida? Greg?
Boise, if Boise gets by Troy, honestly, I think Boise could do it based on reputation. And I'm not going to make any predictions because we always trip up in conference, as you know, Nick, as long as we've been Troy students. But this is by far the most beatable schedule that Troy has ever had since I became a student. Open against Boise, and the only other tough out of conference game is at Nebraska, which is very tough. No doubt, but I think everyone would agree that Nebraska is at least beatable. It's
right.
Conceivable to beat Nebraska and Boise. So I'm looking at the schedule, and it lines really, really well. I'm not going to – there's no way we're going to run the table. We never do.
Right.
But could they get through this season with one loss? I think it's conceivable because, you know, like I said, you have those two games, Boise and Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, you get several of the tough games at home. You do have a road game at App State, which is going to be a tough one.
Right.
But I think this is a – if ever there was a chance for Troy to come up and make a statement nationally as far as making noise for that position, it's this one. But I think Central or Boise and then the way outside dark horse would be Troy.
The only thing about Troy, you know, not to turn this into a Troy podcast, which I'm sure is not interesting to most of our listeners, but – quarterback play, you know, replacing Brandon Silvers, I was very critical of his play at times, even though he was a highly efficient player, that's still a huge replacement because he played, what was it, four straight years. I mean, he started a ton of games, you know, had that experience playing, and now you're going to have to go to somebody who doesn't have that. And for a team that is, you know, focused on spreading the ball around, I feel like inexperience at the quarterback position could wind up really hurting him. But, you know, Central Florida, like I said, is obviously, I think, the Group of Five standout that everyone is pointing to. You mentioned Boise State. Andrew, what about you? Is there anybody else outside of those two that you think could crack that New Year's Six contention?
Well, you mentioned Boise, and I mean, the thing I got to say about Boise, they gave up 22 points a game, and the only defensive player they lost is Aiden Vander Esch.
Right.
So, like, they're bringing everybody back. I don't know if Brett Rippon's really that good, and they lost their top receiver, Cedric Wilson. But the offense is one of those ones where it kind of just kind of always turns. Brian Harrison coaches the team. He was the offensive coordinator. But that defense, like, this is – I remember there was a year in 2012 where they didn't really have anything on offense because they lost everybody. They lost the muscle hamster, Doug Martin. They lost Kellen Moore. But they brought everybody else back on defense, and they just basically won games on defense.
Right.
The thing about Group of Five is that – it's not created equal. And right. Troy had a great year, but they would literally – I mean, I'm being honest. They would literally have to go undefeated in the Sun Belt to get in the group of five. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly
you
right.
Know, and they would need Boise because Boise, he mentioned the Troy game, but they also have to go to Oklahoma State and they have to play San Diego State. And San Diego State, they do two things. They play defense, get running backs to have over 2,000 yards.
Right, yes.
So, like, they're always in the thick of it. I think Rocky Long still coaches there. Mm-hmm. It's just – he always just churns them out. You know, the only thing – ones I could look at because Coosa is a little bit of a slot up on belt, you could look at Marshall, Lane Kiffin at Florida Atlantic, but they lost their quarterback.
See, that was going to be my one, Florida Atlantic. Like, I know they have to go play Oklahoma, and nobody is giving them a realistic shot at beating Oklahoma. But they get UCF in September. If they lose to Oklahoma and, you know, able to beat UCF and win out the rest of the way, I think you have to look at an 11-1 Florida Atlantic team as being worthy of that spot.
Yeah, and the other problem is that, well, first of all, with UCF is that, you know, you don't know if you could recapture the match. You don't know how good Josh Heupel can be as a head coach. Like, he might be able to do it. He did some decent things at Missouri running the offense. But the thing is, like, you know, you still got Mackenzie Milton, but Traquan Smith, he's now playing for us with the Saints. So, like, you know, they had to replace Mike, what was his name? Mike Hughes, mm-hmm. the cornerback and slash kick returner, and Jordan Elkins or Atkins, the tight end. He's gone. And then there's USF, who was really, really good under Charlie Strong. But Quentin Flowers is gone. And, you know, Valdez-Scantling is gone. And Darius Tice is gone. It's like they're still going to be really good at USF. But, you know, they lost a lot of guys. A lot of guys moved on. So I'm not sure there's going to be as much strength at the top of the American. Because whenever you think a group of five, you probably think American and Mountain West. Yep. And then you go down from there. So. Yep.
I would agree with that. And you bring up Josh Heupel. That's a great point about Central Florida is Josh Heupel coming in. If you look at what he did at Missouri, it was more built around air raid principles, whereas UCF, their success under Scott Frost came with kind of that spread option type deal, which granted, I know that version of the spread option is completely different than anything you're going to see just about anywhere else.
And they also brought in Randy Shannon for not only recruiting purposes, mm-hmm. but also because, you know, he's got a lot of history as a coach.
Yeah, it's just going to be interesting to see how they mesh personnel with play calling on the offensive side of it, and whether there's going to be a big drop off for them in terms of continuity. So, yeah.
And though I joked about them, BYU is a dumpster fire of a program right now, so don't expect much.
They had an awful year. Played them in the beginning of the season. When I keep saying we, I mean LSU.
Yep.
I think they had like less than 100 yards of total offense.
Yeah,
it was very. And then they played Wisconsin, and they looked the worst.
I never would have thought Ty Detmer would flame out so badly as an offensive coordinator, but it happened.
I think BYU's issues just highlight, you know, I don't think you're seeing it at Virginia right now, but how good a job Bronco Mendenhall did with that program for several years.
And let me tell you, Virginia is just a pit of bore. So for him to be able to even make Pitt, Virginia, I'm almost mixed Pitt with Virginia because they're in the same conference.
Right.
For Virginia to even be decent is a miracle. I'm not trying to poo-poo on their football program, but they've just never been it. You know.
No, they had like a 2-year run of success in the late 90s, I think.
With Aaron Brooks.
Yeah,
that
was, with Aaron Brooks. With Jones. Aaron Brooks and Jones, the quarterback. Yeah. Thomas Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because Georgia played them in the Peach Bowl in Ray Goff's final game as head coach and lost to them back in, I want to say it was the 98 Peach Bowl.
That was Tim Welch, right? The coach.
96 Peach Bowl, excuse me. I don't remember.
Yeah, and then they had that one good year where Chris Long was a senior. And he was like an All-American defensive lineman.
God, I forgot all about that. This is why we have Andrew Reich on, an encyclopedic memory of Virginia Cavalier football. So
yeah, Al Groh football.
Well, I remember the coach Tommy Welch because the only reason that I remember the late '90s Virginia team is I remember there was a commercial on ESPN that had who is that really southern college football analyst, old man?
Mike.
No, he. Hold on.
You know the one I'm talking about.
Bill Curry.
No, not Bill Curry. The other guy. The other old Tommy. I'm blanking on his name. But nonetheless, he's old and southern. Anyway, on the commercial, it was just him voicing it over, and he was like, Auburn, Virginia, Wales, Bowden, this Saturday night, what more needs to be said?
You know, we laugh at Corso now, but like that was our childhood. Like
Corso is so depressing. Like, it's not even funny to me anymore. Like, he is It is bordering, in my opinion, on exploitation at this point.
We can deep dive about the game day evolution and like whether what's been like marginalized, whether we think it's better because Reese is doing it, whether you think Fowler's done a good job.
I miss Fowler, honestly.
I miss Fowler a lot. Yeah.
But do you miss Brent?
No. God, no. Listen, in terms of incompetent SEC voices, I am so glad that both Vernest and Brent Musburger are no longer associated with the conference.
That's true.
Oh, Hurricane Vern was the greatest.
Hurricane Vern was great from like 2000 to like 2010, but the last 5 years or so where he couldn't tell down the distance or the players' names.
Orlando McLean.
Yes.
To just wheel it back around with a group of five, I'll just give you two. One is just one team, and it's Memphis.
Yeah.
Now, they lose Riley Ferguson and Anthony Miller, who was like – that was a scoring machine. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how good they could be, but they didn't – but Mike Norvell not take a head coaching job elsewhere, so he's back. Mm-hmm. And they bring back a lot of guys, but they have to replace the quarterback. And then the entire MAC, because I know they had the one year where Row the Boat, you know, Western Michigan got mm-hmm. to the group of five and played Wisconsin. But it just seems like there's so many teams, and they all just kind of cannibalize each other.
Right.
Do you think any of them ones in the MAC – kind of interest you?
I mean, Toledo always seems like they're really good. Like, I can't name you a single Toledo player, but it feels like they're in contention for the MAC title every single year.
Northern Illinois.
Yep.
Northern's got this one guy who's like a sacking machine. I'm forgetting his name. Right. Sutton Smith.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. They were just talking about him on SiriusXM the other day. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say that regarding Memphis, I think the great tragedy of them is that we're not going to be able to hear Beth Mowen say, Riley Ferguson!
Oh, God, Beth Mowen, 100 times a game. We're just going to have to do an all, like, ESPN personality bash podcast, essentially, at some point.
A sneaky favorite, in October, they play Missouri. So keep an eye on that.
Memphis does. Interesting.
Memphis plays Missouri. And remember, that's how Ole Miss, when they had mm-hmm. that – I mean, look, I would rather be caught dead than to compliment Ole Miss for anything. But they had a really awesome team in 2015 when they had Kelly and they had Laquon Treadwell.
Yeah, you ain't got to tell me.
And they went to Memphis and they lost to Memphis when they had the one who's now quarterbacking the Broncos, Lynch.
Yeah.
And so not a trap game. It's not like Memphis. I don't know if Missouri's got the trot, but that'll be an entertaining game.
Absolutely. All right. Well, real quick before we move on from the group of five, let's go ahead and put our New Year's Six pick on the record because, you know, part of the deal is that the group of five gets a mandatory New Year's Six slot. I'm going to go chalk and I'm going to say South Florida. Greg, what about you?
Without looking at the schedules right now, I'm going to say Boise.
Okay. What about you, Reese?
As long as they can get by Oklahoma State, Boise State's going to be
the Boise best. State. There you go. And real quick, one last thing. Is there one game in the group of five that you guys think is going to shape that landscape? I'm going to say Florida Atlantic, Central Florida in September. I think it's September 27th as I referenced.
Boise and Troy.
Boise and Troy, nice.
I'll stick with Memphis and Missouri.
Memphis, Mizzou. Okay, good deal. All right, well, let's move on to the ACC. We're going to start, just got to run through the Power Five alphabetically. And I feel like all the preseason focus in the ACC right now, it's on Clemson in one division, Miami in the other. Who is the third best team in the ACC, Greg?
Third best team in the ACC. Okay, this is going to be probably pretty controversial, I think, based on how they played last year and the changeover in system. But, well, you know what? Actually, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go Virginia Tech. Never mind. I was going to say Florida State. I'm not willing to go there. I'm going to put Florida State fourth behind Virginia Tech.
Reesh?
Ooh. I mean, now that you throw the monkey wrench in, but whether they're the third best. I mean, Florida State's probably the third most talented. They might even be a little more talented than Miami still because they lost Derwin James and they lost Tavares McFadden and they lost this guy and that guy. They still got a lot of blue chippers that Jimbo Fisher had, you know, rallied up. And they got a lot of talent. And, you know, Willie Taggart is not a bad coach. Like, a lot of people thought, oh, this is a sloppy seconds type of hire. And it's like, no, Taggart got all the way up to being the Oregon head coach. I'll give you a sneaky one. NC State is pretty good. You know, they had their, like, entire defensive line drafted. And they still have Ryan Finley. The problem is they lose Samuels and Naheem Hines. And those guys are so – I think Jamar Samuels played, like – how many positions on offense for NC State? Like four or five?
Right.
You know, he played like tight end and fullback and, you know, scat back and all that stuff. So, I mean, I'm really scared about how much talent they lost. But I feel like Dave Doran, the coach, he's done a really good job of keeping the talent in and keeping them as long as he can. I don't want to go that far, though, and say it's NC State, but I would say that's like a dark horse. But I'll stick with Florida State as the third most talented.
Yeah, I'm torn between Florida and Virginia Tech, and the interesting thing there is they're going to play week one on a Monday night in Tallahassee to open the year. I mean, a huge conference game for both of those schools because, like you alluded to, Florida State had a terrible year last year. But if you look at their what they've done on the recruiting trail, from a pure roster standpoint, they're probably as talented as anybody else in the league, not named
Yeah,
Clemson.
And it's not like James Blackman was terrible, but they lost DeAndre Francois literally the first
the
game.
The first of game of the season.
Right.
Against Alabama.
That's going to be an interesting – I think that's one of the probably the second most interesting quarterback battle to watch this offseason is Francois and Blackman, because I thought Blackman was playing really good football at the end of the season. However, I've seen DeAndre Francois when he's on, what he can offer, and you know it's just gonna. And I think he fits better into what Taggart wants to do than Blackman does. But it's gonna be interesting to see who wins that out. And I think you know if they can commit to a quarterback, that could make a big difference for them moving forward.
Also,
we didn't get to see him dominate as much last year as he should have because the offense became so one-dimensional. I still think Cam Akers
is one of the
most talented running backs in the country.
No doubt.
He has the ability, I think, to get in the Heisman discussion this year. I believe he's the best back in that conference.
They also bring in Harlan Bennett, who coached the second in Michigan State for years. And, so we'll see how that goes.
And Taggart likes to bring along a lot of those principles from the old Art Briles offense at Baylor, where if you remember watching Baylor a few years ago, they would line up receivers so far outside the hashes that it was pretty much taking, you know, two members of your secondary out of the play, and there were running lanes often for their running backs. They never had great running backs, but they could always gash people in the run game whenever they wanted to, and I'm thinking Cam Akers is going to be operating in a ton of space this year.
Yeah, I don't think Taggart gets credit for how much he developed Quentin Flowers, and also just in one year how he developed Justin Herbert at Oregon.
Yeah.
You know, Herbert was considered by many kind of a lost case. And he made something out of him right before he left for Florida State. People say the Todd Graham jokes about Taggart because he left Oregon after 1 year and kind of did the same thing at Pitt. But that was a job you couldn't pass up. You know, that Florida State job is one of like the top 10 jobs in college football.
And nobody thought it was legitimately going to come open. I mean, I think a lot of us thought that once Jimbo has, you know, flirtation with LSU that didn't wind up happening, a lot of us assumed he was going to be at Florida State for the long term.
Jimbo kind of did Florida State dirty.
Yes.
A little bit.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. But we've spent all this time talking about Florida State. What's the ceiling for them? Can they go from a 6-6 team they were last year and bounce all the way back to ACC title contention? Or do we think it's a cut below Clemson?
They're a cut below Clemson because Clemson's defensive line is just way too good.
I would agree.
They could literally lose two of the defensive linemen, and they'll still give up less than 15 points a game.
Yeah.
You know, I watched them play Auburn, and they sacked Jared Stidham, I want to say 11 times.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
And listen, a lot of people got a bad taste in their mouth when it comes to Clemson because in the Sugar Bowl, they just couldn't move the ball against Alabama's defense. It was one of those, like, irresistible force of movable object kind of things where defense was the name of the game for both guys. And when in a battle, Alabama just kind of outsmarted them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it left a bad taste in their mouth, but also because of the fact that they were so disappointing every pack. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a silver lining to that loss. I mean, there always is in college. The beauty of college is that you have those setbacks the year before, but it makes you stronger the next year.
That motivation, people can laugh it off and say it's overrated, but that motivation makes a big factor at top-level college football. It's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it play out. I know you've seen it play out, and so have you, Nick. It makes a difference. Coaches can use the strangest motivators sometimes, and I think Clemson's going to be back bigger and badder this year,
especially in bowl games that matter. Right. You know, like, I mean, you see some bowl games where you almost use it as an exhibition. Whereas if you go, I mean, I think Oklahoma, the way they got clowned by Clemson in the playoff, I think they got better from that.
They did.
You know, the next 2 years. And another example is Ohio State. They got embarrassed by Clemson. Mm-hmm. They came back stronger, even though, you know, Ohio State situation is complicated and it always feels like they kind of underachieve. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, let's just kind of switch to Clemson. The thing that's interesting is that Kelly Bryant was mildly disappointed, but you're also following up maybe like the best college football quarterback since Vince Young and Deshaun Watson. So it's really, really hard to match that. But then they bring in Trevor Lawrence and he's the bee's knees. And now everybody's thinking that Lawrence is just going to take the job.
Yeah, that's going to be the interesting thing because you got to look at Kelly Bryant, who last year, you know, was able to keep that job in a quarterback battle before – or win the job, excuse me, in preseason camp. And now he's kind of in a similar position to what Jalen Hurts is in. I mean, look at Kelly Bryant, who went 12-13-1 as a starter. 12-1 as a starter. And now he's in a competition with a true freshman. It's just – it speaks to how much things have changed in college football over the last 15 to 20 years because freshmen coming in straight out of high school and winning the starting jobs, that was almost always an indicator of how thin you were at the quarterback position rather than an indicator of how good a guy was.
And teams didn't used to recruit multiple quarterbacks within 2 years of each other.
Right.
Because there was – you know, you recruit your guy and he's your guy.
Yeah.
It's – but it's become more and more A, what have you done for me lately? And also B, the most talented guy or the guy that's the best fit for the system is going to play and has to play.
That's a great point because guys like Kelly Bryant, who's a senior now, those were the guys. Like those are the – like T. Martin at Tennessee.
T. Martin.
Like, you know, and the quarterback who – Greg can help me. The quarterback who learned behind Blake Sims and A.J. McCarron.
Oh, Jay Coker.
Those are those kinds of guys that kind of fester and they somewhat develop. And even when they get the starting job, they're not great, but they're just good enough. We saw that with Jarrett Lee at LSU. Trevor Lawrence, he's more of an example of like a Jameis Winston. Jameis Winston started this, where it's like, oh, we could just plug this guy in. He's the missing piece. You almost look at it as an acquisition, you know, and the transfer market, oh my God. Like, look at Blake Barnett. Blake Barnett was like an agent, you know?
Yeah. That hasn't worked out quite so well for him.
But the strength for Clemson is that running game. You got Travis Etienne, you got Tevin Feaster, you got Adam Choice. You know, Hunter Renfrow is still there.
My God, it feels like he's been there for 20 years. Just leave. Sorry.
Why don't you just die? But the strength is the defense, of course.
Yeah.
But that's where it's at. I mean, they gave up 13.6 points a game.
They're horrifying up front.
I mean,
they're absolutely horrifying up front.
They've got four guys that are going to be top two round picks in the NFL draft next year. I wouldn't be surprised if all four of them are first round picks.
Dexter Lawrence and Christian Wilkins will be first or second round guaranteed.
They have got legitimate NFL guys across that defensive line, and it's not like they recruited a bunch of three stars behind them. They have built depth on the defensive line that probably only Alabama can match.
Well, they copied the Alabama plan, which is you just crop up the highly touted prospects and just keep funneling them in over and over and over again. If you do that, then they'll regardless of how many starters you lose, there's never a drop off. Now imagine if Alabama has a year where they keep most of their defense. That's kind of what this is. And you're in a weaker conference.
Yes.
This would have been like if that 2015 Alabama defensive front had come back in 16, as good as the defense was in 16. And Clemson has that now.
Yeah.
And with that level of depth up front, that level of pass rush, because, you know, that Alabama defense of 2016. So that Alabama defense of 2 years ago had the best pass rush I've ever seen at Alabama. And this Clemson defensive line is comparable to it. It is horrifying for an opposing offensive line.
The only warning is the 2015 Ohio State syndrome, whereas you get a lot of hype, you got a lot of future pros. Do you have a long factor?
Right.
That's the only fear you got there. And, you know, they play Jimbo again. Poor Jimbo.
Right.
He gets away from Clemson, and he's got to play Clemson in the first, like, the second game of the season.
Yep.
Because Clemson goes to Texas A&M.
So, I'm looking at Florida State's schedule right now, and a couple of games that stand out to me, you already mentioned the Virginia Tech Monday night game, Nick, to start the season. That's going to be huge. At Miami is going to be big, obviously. We know the Clemson game is going to be big. But then Notre Dame at home is a stands out as a big one. November 10th.
At Notre Dame, actually. That's in South Bend.
Oh, yeah, that's right. My schedule is
they go to Louisville where when stinking. Lamar Jackson was there, they shredded him to pieces. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think Louisville. But can we mention Louisville for just a minute? I hate to say this because my team's playing them, and I don't want to jinx anything. But gosh,
Orlando, the first game of the season. Yeah,
yeah. Louisville's gonna have a rough year. I think.
I think okay. so. I think so as well. Not to get too far off from these top tier ACC teams, but one team that I'm going to throw out there for you guys to keep an eye on. I don't think they're an ACC title contender, but I think they can win 8-9 games. Boston College. They bring back A.J. Dillon at running back as a sophomore. He rushed for over 1,500 yards as a true freshman. You're in, I think, year four of Steve Adazio at BC. I think they could be an 8-9 win legit top 25 team this year.
And Zach Allen and Lucas Dennis are like big time players
mm-hmm.
on the defensive end. I mean, now they lose Cameron Moore and they lose Harold Landry. You know, now Harold Landry did not have a great final year, but he racked up sacks and tackles the year before that.
Yeah.
So, you know, Adazio does fine. He was under pressure a couple of years ago. The other thing is they bring literally the entire offense back. Yep. Anthony Brown is back too, and the kick returner Mike Walker's back. Like they got them all. So this is the year for them that they do it.
Does anybody think Syracuse takes a step this season?
I want them to so badly because I love watching them play and I love Dino Babers in an interview. But, like, Syracuse is just – they don't have any talent. Like, and I don't mean that in terms of nationally stacking up against the big boys. If you look at ACC recruiting rankings, they are routinely bottom four in that conference along with, like, Wake Forest. And, I mean, it's just – it's so hard to get guys to go to Syracuse for whatever reason these days. I don't know what it is, but
I would play for them on the basis of their mascot.
An orange.
They did beat Clemson
they
at
did.
Home.
And didn't win again the rest of the year.
That's unbelievable, too. We played them. LSU did. Eric Dungy is really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those sneaky good quarterbacks in college football, like or kind of like one of those who was the one that's now with the Chiefs that quarterback
Mahomes, Patrick Mahomes,
kind of one of those where mm-hmm. I don't know if the team's good, but I really like watching him, and that's what Eric Dungy's like. But they lose Steve Ishmael. Steve Ishmael was like Mr. Do Everything as a wide receiver, so we'll see if Babers can kind of like replicate that with some new personnel.
One team we haven't talked about yet, and we'll touch on them briefly, is Miami. I think everyone is looking at what Miami did last year. And let's be honest, I think Mark Richt was probably a year ahead taking them to an ACC title game mm-hmm. in year two. But everyone is just kind of assuming they're going to win that division. And I'm kind of like you, Greg. I'm sitting here going, man, a lot of people are sleeping on Virginia Tech because I was very impressed what Justin Fuente has done there to this point. You know, maybe it's still me as a Georgia fan waiting for Mark Richt to inevitably, like, choke something away, but I kind of don't look at it.
Stayed at home. You get Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech on the road. But I don't know, like...
Mark Richt has never lost a game at Georgia Tech, by the way.
Wow, I did not know that.
That's hilarious because I remember when he lost to Georgia Tech a couple times at home.
Well, lost twice to him in Athens, but had never lost to them in Atlanta.
I never knew that. Wow.
Well, and the other thing about Miami is I believe they're going to be at very least good. I mean, a Mark Richt coach team is going to be good. It's the question of are they going to win that division? And it's hard to say. I want to see their offense take some more steps up this year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year they relied so much on the turnover chain, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I want to see their offense take a step up and produce at the level that it's capable of. So
I'm going to say this out of the fear of giving PTSD to Nick Duke, who has a lot of familiarity, of course, with Mark Richt. Here's the constant, like eternal problem with a Mark Richt coach team. They're always good, but are they really that good? Like it's always that, but are we sure kind of situation with every team that Mark Richt has coached.
And they always lay an egg in an inexplicable situation like with Pitt last year.
Exactly, and look at the sequence of the Miami seasons. The first year there, they win four in a row. They lose four in a row. Mm-hmm. Then they win four in a row to finish. Then look at last year where turnover chain and all that sort of went their way, and they had a lot of close wins, I remember, too.
Mm-hmm.
They win like 10 in a row. Then they drop the shocker to Pitt, and then they clown by clown, and then they lose to Wisconsin because let's just be honest, Wisconsin was better.
Right, yeah.
In the Orange Bowl. But, you know, they win 10 in a row, then they lose through the rail. Now they play LSU. Now, maybe this is more of a definitive game for them in terms of their program, because remember, when they played LSU in a bowl game about maybe 13 years ago, they got clowned by LSU when LSU was on the rise. And that was the beginning of the end of the Larry Coker era. And I wonder if they're kind of use this as sort of a launching pad for their program of, oh, we're back, we're rally type of deal. But that's the problem with a Mark Richt coach team. There's always that other shoe that's going to drop.
Well, here's
– you know.
Yeah, I agree completely. But here's the other thing, though. We say that, but if Mark Richt gets the usual 9-10 win level, that may very well be enough to win that division, because it all comes down to what Virginia Tech does. Because let's face it, Georgia Tech is Georgia Tech. They're going to do what they're going to do. Virginia's not a contender. Duke's not a contender. Pittsburgh's not a contender.
You're saying Pitt's not going to get to the top?
I'm saying that if Dan Marino comes out of retirement and plays for them, they might have a shot at getting to the top.
That still wouldn't be good enough.
Yeah, you're right. They probably just he put up great numbers.
But you get what I'm saying about Miami? I mean, and listen, like Joe Jackson, Shaquille Quarterman, Michael Jackson, Jaquan Johnson, like those guys may all be like legitimately really good players down the road. But we've seen this story before where it's like, yeah, they're really good. Their talent, is it all going to manifest at the same time?
Right.
Is the time going to match up?
On the counterpoint, is Virginia Tech going to step up and improve their record enough to get over that hump and pass Miami this year? I don't know.
They survived the scare with losing. We almost thought they lost Josh Jackson to academics, but they didn't. So that would have been a killer for Virginia Tech.
Well, that's actually an excellent segue. Let's go ahead and pick our game of the year in the ACC, and I'm going to go to that game, Miami-Virginia Tech, November 17th. I think that game decides the Coastal Division.
Yeah, hard to argue with that one. That's a good one. That's a good one. I think that would be my pick too. If I had to pick another one, I think I would say I would move to Florida State at Miami. I think is going to be really interesting. But yeah, that's the one, I think, because you're right. That's pretty much going to determine the division. Because my point earlier was that none of the other teams in the division, besides those two, have a realistic shot, in my opinion.
Right.
I don't know about you, Nick. You know more about the Roman Reigns-led Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets than I do. But I don't see them bouncing back to their former glory.
Here's the thing with Georgia Tech. The triple option is a pain in the ass to prepare for. Like, let's just be honest.
Unless you Clemson and it's no problem.
Right, but the thing about it is you can't recruit top-level guys come in and play that system because they know it's hard to get to the league coming out of that. So Georgia Tech is going to win every year three games they probably shouldn't win, but by the same token, they're probably going to lose two or three games they have no business losing. They are going to be 7-5, 8-4, and yeah, I know you're going to point to what Paul did his first year at Georgia Tech, but remember, he had Chan Gailey's guys. He had freaking Demaryius Thomas on a triple option team, which is ridiculous. He had a lot of legitimate NFL talent, and has never had a talented again. So I look at Georgia Tech and I go, the ceiling for them is probably 9 wins, but I don't think that's good enough to win the division.
The game I would look at, Clemson goes to Boston College November 10th. Classic Clemsoning trap game.
There you go. Yeah, because as good as Clemson is, do we all assume they're going undefeated? Because it's kind of hard to do that. I know the ACC is down, and it feels like if they were going to do it, this would be the year. But like you guys said, it always feels like – I mean, look at Syracuse last year. It feels like there's one game where they trip up. And when you're talking about 18 to 22-year-old kids, it's really hard to get these kids to lock in each and every week.
Their best team ever in 2016 still didn't get out unscathed. They lost to Pittsburgh.
And probably should have lost to NC State.
The odds of going undefeated were very low. You know.
Under Nick Saban, the only time Alabama, which has been the dominant program for all these years, as people remind me incessantly, the only undefeated team is 9. Not a single one of the championship teams since then has been undefeated. It's really hard to do.
And if we're going to go way back there, they should have lost to Tennessee.
Oh, wow. Is that the one Lane Kiffin year?
He's referring to the
Badass Cody.
Mount removing his helmet.
Oh, I call him Fat Ass Cody.
Good Lord.
He was we're going to have an LSU and Alabama podcast at some point going through that.
Yeah. I don't look forward to that week. me and Greg always ramp up the techs around then.
Yeah.
But it's always fun.
Hey, this year I get to get in on the action a little bit, sir, because I'm actually making my way down to Baton Rouge, but we will talk
that. Wait, hold on. We have to play Georgia this year?
Yes. Yes, you do.
Who fucked up the schedule? How'd that happen? It's our job to get away from games like that.
Yeah, but granted, you get them both. You get both Georgia and Alabama at home, so there you go.
Is Georgia coming off a bye?
No.
Damn it. You didn't do your job. Didn't do your job, Oliva.
But, so I think those are our games of the year in the ACC. Who you got in the championship game? I mean, I think we're all probably going to say Clemson. I'm going to say Virginia Tech and Clemson in the ACC title game. I, of course, like Clemson to come out of the ACC. Greg, what about you?
I like Clemson and Miami again in a repeat of last year, and I like Clemson to beat them just as convincingly.
Yep. Andrew?
Clemson and definitely not Duke and definitely North Carolina and definitely not Georgia Tech, and I guess it's Miami.
Fair enough. And you're making the assumption that Clemson's going to boat race them like we are.
Here's a sneaky one. I mean, we could talk about job security, the whole thing. Larry Fedora, do or die this year at North Carolina?
Man, so when you combine his showing at Media Days, which brought that university and that athletic program a level of scrutiny it did not need with all the academic impropriety that has gone on over the last couple of years, and you combine that with the off-the-field issues now, all the players being suspended for multiple games for profiting off of team merchandise and stuff like that, it is building up to not be a very good scenario for Fedora, which is crazy considering 2 or 3 years ago when they played Clemson in the ACC title game, if they had found a way to win that game, a lot of people were saying they were going to be in the playoff.
And that's what you get for inheriting the zombie-like disease that is Brandon Harris.
That's a great point. That's a great point. It's the rare example of North Carolina is a team that has gotten markedly worse since Gene Chizik left it, which I know is rare, but it actually happened.
Oh, my God. Well, and the other thing, yeah, here's the thing about Larry Fedora. He's just not very good.
Now, he was good at Southern Miss, though. Like, he did some things at Southern Miss.
He was, but he also inherited a lot of decent talent. Now, he's also done a good job of, like Mitchell Trubisky was not a guy who just dropped at his feet. They developed him. You know, so they've done an okay job. Even that awful, awful year that they just had, they still got some guys in the NFL.
Right.
So
very true. But yeah, I think with all that development and all that time, I mean, Eric Ebron came out of there too, who has been a bust of the NFL, but was a very good college tight end.
Giovanni Bernard.
With all that talent, though, that skill position talent, to watch them run such horrendous performances as I've seen them in bowl games and in big games against other teams, it's like, how does this happen? How do you have a guy like Mitch Trubisky, who, yes, nobody's going to be in the NFL, but has all these physical tools, and then you can't get anything – you can't get a sustained level of success
To be fair to Fedora, they lost so much of the offense with Trubisky. It wasn't just him. They lost Switzer. Mm-hmm. They lost another receiver. They lost their top two running backs who got drafted. It was going to be rough no matter what. They just didn't realize how far of a fall was going to be. And the ACC, I mean, the microscope's there. They've won a national championship. They've been to the playoff, I'm pretty sure, every year since the playoff started. So, yes. Like, there's a microscope there for not just Clemson and not just Miami and Florida State. Every team. So you can't be awful. If you're awful and you bottom out and North Carolina bottoms out, Fedora's gone.
I would tend to agree with that. And I think there's a strong possibility of them bottoming out because, like I said, you look at all those off-the-field issues and then you combine it with the fact that their schedule this year is fairly tough. I mean, you got winnable games against Pitt. You know, you can probably win that game, but they play Central Florida. They've got to go at Cal in week one. Not that Cal's great, but that's a 3,000-mile road trip, which is never easy with college kids. You got to go at Miami. You got to go at Virginia. You got to go at Duke.
I was just about to mention, Duke is not a walk in the park anymore.
David Cutt always going to have a solid team. They may not be great, but you're going to have to play well to beat them, and that's been the hallmark at Duke for the last several years.
people are hung up on Cutcliffe because he's the offensive mastermind such and such, and they had that one crazy bowl game against A&M when Johnny
Yeah.
So everyone hangs their hat on that, saying, "Oh yeah, they're like a zany weird team." They're actually a pretty good defensive team year in and year out.
Yeah.
So
they play bread and butter football too. They really don't trick you. They don't do anything wild and crazy. They just have great offensive fundamentals. Mm-hmm. They play with discipline, and they're that kind of team that, you know, you're coasting when you go in there to play them, and you're having ups and downs, three and outs here and there.
Yeah. And then Jeremy Kett,
casually putting up field goals over and over and over again.
And then Jeremy Cash gets an interception. Now he's gone, but Joe Giles Harris is back. So there you go.
Let's put a ball on the ACC for now, and let's move over to arguably, and I would still take some issue with this, no matter what everybody else says, arguably the best conference in college football, and unquestionably the conference in college football that has had the most intriguing offseason, and that would be the Big Ten. And there is no way to begin this discussion without at least addressing the elephant in the room. And let's just, in full disclosure, we are recording this a full 2 weeks before the weekend of August 25th, which is when we'll have the first little opening salvo of some minor games. So by the time you're hearing this podcast, this discussion we're about to have could be completely irrelevant. Andrew, Greg and I have had this discussion offline a little bit in our personal lives, so I'm going to pose the question to you. What's your gut feeling on how this Urban Meyer thing resolves itself? And more specifically, how does it impact Ohio State on the field this year?
Wow. If Urban Meyer – let's just get the street story. If Urban Meyer doesn't coach and say – let's say, for example – I mean, I don't know about the particulars of the politics and who would take the place. Let's say it's Kevin Wilson or Greg Schiano who does it in his place. That could be a 2 or 3 game swing, you know, in terms of wins and losses. You know, I'm not – a lot of people point to the 2011 year when Luke Fickell took Jim Tressel's place, and they – I don't have the record in front of me, but it was not – they just were not that good. 6-7, I just saw it.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to go that far because Jim Tressel left behind a very talented team at Ohio State when he got shown the door. But Urban Meyer has built – like a castle talent at Ohio State.
Right.
Like they raise your interactive hands. Like, is there any team that's more talented than Ohio State in the Big Ten?
No.
Just based on the paper roster.
No.
Not even close. Not even within the same
zip code. And Michigan has done a good job of rallying up. Penn State's had a nice run. Michigan's had a dip, and then they came back strong. And Wisconsin, we'll get to them later. But Ohio State is the team. So it's like it's to the point where, like, when they lose, it's like a shock. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't believe that they lost. Mm-hmm. You know. And if look at their non-conference, the TCU game in Arlington, a glorified road game, that's going to be tough, especially if they don't have Urban. Do I think Urban's not going to coach? I think Urban will coach. But I don't know if he'll survive the offseason onslaught after that, if more facts come out.
Yeah.
But I do think he will come back.
Yeah, my thinking on this kind of shifted. When it first started, it sounded – I mean, I was thinking, man, there's no way he survives this. And the longer it goes on, I think the more it bodes well for him. But I think there's
he's been admitting the more. That's
right.
The thing.
But I think there's got to be some sort of disaction. I'm thinking maybe a 2-4 game suspension. But – even if it's only 2-4 games, I think this whole distraction during preseason camp, these sort of things matter when you're talking about college kids. It's the kind of thing that could probably be survived in the NFL, but I don't know that it has like a 2-3 game swing impact. But one game in the Big Ten East, which is arguably the toughest division in all of college football, one game could be the difference between you playing for a big title and you going to the Rose Bowl instead of the playoff. You know what I mean? Like,
Absolutely.
That's where I'm at with it right now is I don't know how big the impact is going to be, but any impact has the potential to be massive.
The divisional standings in the last 2 years in that Big Ten East has been razor thin. It literally came down to the last game.
Right.
The last game played, which is usually the big game, which is Ohio State, Michigan. Which Ohio State in perpetuity.
They own Michigan. Yeah.
Now, if Urban Meyer doesn't coach, then Bucciano takes the fall.
I've told Nick this off the air. My hot take, I don't think anything comes of this outside of a slap on the wrist. I think he'll get I'm going to go ahead and I will be aggressive. I will be liberal with my use of punishment here, and I will say they will give him a 2-game suspension to start the season. Those 2 games, home against Oregon State, who they will blow out regardless of who's coaching.
Good point.
Home against Rutgers, who they will blow out regardless of who's coaching. Urban will come back for the TCU game. That's going to be a tough game regardless. And then where I differ from Nick a little bit is I don't think it's going to make a difference because they don't have a tough in-game, in-conference game until the end of September with Penn State. And that's going to be hard regardless of whether he coaches or not. I feel like if he only misses 2 games or if he misses no games, certainly, I don't think it's going to take them that long to figure it out and to get that back where it needs to be. And then Ohio State, Penn State becomes – the game, which I don't want to spoil my pick here, but it becomes the game for that conference to decide who moves on.
And say that, Greg, I think it opens up another point of discussion where I think you and I differ a little bit because you say the game is Ohio State, Penn State, and I'm still kind of thinking the game in the Big Ten East this year is Ohio State and Michigan. I'm higher on Michigan than you are. They bring back pretty much their entire defense from a defense that was very good a year ago, and they bring in Shea Patterson, who I think is going to make a difference. Is he going to be, you know, a Heisman Trophy candidate or anything like that? No. But they have gotten average quarterback at best ever since Harbaugh has been there, and I think Shea Patterson is going to be their first really good talent under center for them, and I think that does make a big difference, and I think they have the potential to win 10 or 11 games probably.
They've had the potential to win 10 or 11 games every year since Harbaugh's been there is the problem.
But, again, the quarterback issues is what I'm pointing to.
Well, I don't know. When it's been that many quarterbacks, it's hard for me to blame the quarterbacks when instead of looking at the coach.
And this is that missing piece scenario where, all they needed was a quarterback. They never had one. So will Shea Patterson be able to do it? We kind of saw this, I want to say, with Russell Wilson when he went to Wisconsin for that 1 year.
Yep.
I'm not trying to poo-poo on Scott Tolzien or whoever came after that who was probably bad. But 1 year that they had Wilson, like that was the year where I was like, okay, this is what a complete team would look like. I don't know if Shea Patterson makes Michigan a complete team. I think he's just a good quarterback that just happened to land at Michigan. So the thing about Michigan is that they bring like almost the entire defense back.
True.
Rayshon Gary, who was like the number one prospect a few years ago, was a junior, which almost guarantees this is his last year in –
Right.
So will he take the leap?
And well, I think the thing holding me back also on saying that Ohio State Penn State is the game is Penn State. I mean, no Trace McSorley, no Saquon Barkley.
No, Trace McSorley is back.
McSorley is
back. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
My mistake on that
one. And they bring back DeAndre Tompkins and Juwan Johnson, but they did lose Barkley. They lost lost Hamilton. Mm-hmm. They lost some guys. It's almost their entire defense.
Yes.
Right. But I do think –
don't get me started.
But I do think James Franklin's a hell of a coach and that he's got Penn State to a place where it hasn't been in a long, long time.
Oh, yeah. So. When I was watching play Washington, because we'll get to the Pac-12 later, Washington's a legit good team. They've been a good team for 3 years. When I watched them play Penn State, I was like, wow, Penn State's just better. You know, that's just a better team than Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And that's saying something because – you know, had stockpiled some pretty good talent. We talked in generality about Ohio State, but if you kind of dig really deep, they still lose. They always lose guys, but it's again like Clemson and Alabama. Mm-hmm. They just recruits constantly. They bring back all their receivers, but they do lose JT Barrett.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how that's. They bring back J.K. Dobbins, who was their top runner. You know, and they got like a million running backs probably behind Dobbins. So,
but every report we've heard is that this Haskins kid is legit. In terms of, you know, being the heir apparent at quarterback to the point where LSU is kind of the beneficiary a little bit of him.
Because they got Joe Burrow.
Because Joe Burrow transferred out and went down south. So, you know, it's like we said earlier, talent-wise, there's no reason Ohio State shouldn't win the conference. I just question whether the off-the-field stuff impacts them enough that it keep them from winning it. And I think
it certainly opens the door for, in that division, Penn State, who we've talked about, Michigan, who we've talked about, and Jim Harbaugh, and you can make the argument, is coaching for his job here. And then the team we haven't mentioned is
the nugget in the toilet.
A Michigan State team that won 10 games last year.
The one you can't flush, yes.
Yep, they bounce back after a horrible year the year before. They're right back where they were.
In virtually every preseason magazine or poll you look at, the Big Ten has five teams in the top 10 to 15, and it's Ohio State, Wisconsin, Michigan, Penn State, and Michigan State kind of round out that group. And I feel like it could very well be a thing where at the end of the year you look at Michigan State and you say they are a legitimate top 10 team, but they might be the fourth best team in their own division. I think that's a
Michigan
possibility.
Michigan State brings back everybody, including their quarterback, Brian Lewerke. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's back.
It's going to be interesting.
They're going to be a dangerous team. And we haven't talked about the other division, and Wisconsin is the staple there. They are always good. They're always a 9-11 win team every year. Mm-hmm. They were exceptional last year. They played very good football the entire season, beat a lot of good teams. And quite frankly, they play division with a lot of contenders this year. Like, to me, it looks like it's going to be Wisconsin's division again. But I will say, the team, I've talked to you about this, Nick. I don't think they're going to contend for the division, but I do believe that Nebraska is going to be a thorn in the side of some of the better teams in this conference. I'm looking at their schedule right now, and I believe they're going to beat some combination of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio State, who they're playing this year, all on the road. I think they're going to win one of those games against one of those teams, which could have long-lasting effects come the end of the season.
You're drinking that Scott Frost Kool-Aid really hard.
I am. I believe he's going to make a huge
Scott Frost hard lemonade. Yeah.
I believe he'll make a difference a lot quicker than people are giving him credit for.
Well, they bring back their top two receivers and all their running backs.
Mm-hmm. The thing there is just trying to figure out how the personnel fits into the Scott.
A top-tier team, and they're going to be right there, in my opinion, finishing second in the division.
You know, I can't sit in the division because I feel like every year when we look at the Big Ten West, we overlook Iowa every single year, and every single year they beat somebody they have no business beating. Like, look at that Ohio State game last year,
yes,
or taking Penn State down to the wire last year.
I mean, should have beaten Penn State.
Yes,
yeah,
they should have.
Absolutely.
And 2 years ago, was it not? They were playing for, or 2 or 3 years ago, they were playing for a Big Ten title. You know, it's one of those things where I think people overlook Kirk Ferentz and the job he does with Iowa each and every year. So that we just kind of need to keep them in the back of our minds when we talk about the Big Ten. No, I don't think they can win the conference, but I think they will have a say in who does wind up winning.
What about Northwestern that closed the season by winning 8 games last year that I didn't even realize until I just looked at it on this website that I'm on right now? But I had that Northwestern won their last 8 games last year.
Here's the thing about Northwestern. Does the Clayton Thorson stuff sort of like dip in and give them a little too much overhype? That's because they've never – the one thing that Northwestern football has never been a victim of is overhype. Like, they just –
That's it's true.
And listen, they've gone three times in the last 6 seasons. Like, that's not easy, especially in the Big Ten.
The thing that holds me up about Northwestern – let's look at the schedule real quick. And I point to 2 different 3-game stretches, or actually, you know, honestly, even the opening of the season, at Purdue to open the year, which Purdue last year
Thursday night
surprised everyone by being as good as they were. Home against Duke, who we discussed earlier, is usually better than people think. But they've got a 3-game stretch at the end of September and the start of October where they go home against Michigan, at Michigan State, home against Nebraska. And then October into November, they got Wisconsin, Notre Dame, and Iowa back-to-back-to-back.
That's a tough one.
Very possible they could lose 5 games and maybe still, you know, be a better team than they were a year ago, but be 7-5. You know, is what I'm looking.
But they do duck Ohio State and Penn State, which helps them.
Right, and that circles back around talking about schedules. The one thing about Wisconsin that I think we need to talk about is whereas last year they were the beneficiary of a fairly weak schedule, not so much this year. Wisconsin has to go at Michigan and at Penn State this year, whereas a year ago they were able to dodge a lot of the top-tier teams out of the Big Ten East.
Yeah, and look at Iowa. Ohio State. Look at it, no Michigan and no Michigan State. Now, this happened in 2015 because they went undefeated, and a lot of people felt like they didn't play anybody good.
And they didn't.
You know, except for Wisconsin. And then they lost that close one to Michigan State in the Big Ten title game. I don't see that this year for Iowa. I don't see like the sequencing matching up where it's like, oh, this is the year where they can peak and go undefeated down all the way down. But you know, in the Big Ten and in some of these big conferences, we saw it with Miami last year, it happens. You'll see some of these teams where they just kind of catch fire and this, everything sort of works out exactly, but then the bottom falls out at the very end, you know.
What about PJ Fleck in his second year at Minnesota? Can he turn it around?
And then you got to run with that boat.
You know, it's what, if he were in the East, he would have no chance. But because he plays in the West, I guess it depends on what your definition of turning it around is. Like,
well, from five, can he go from 5-7 to or that 8-9 win level that signifies they're moving in the direction that they wanted when they hired PJ Fleck?
I'm looking at the schedule right now and think Iowa, Ohio, they could probably win 8 games because I'm looking at the schedule right now. I think Ohio State and Iowa are losses. I think Wisconsin is a loss, and I think they probably split Purdue and Northwestern. That gets them to 8-4. Yeah, I don't see any reason they can't do that.
They win. They had that stretch where I remember. Didn't they have the one who plays for the Falcons now, DeAndre Campbell, right?
Mm-hmm, DeAndre Campbell.
They had a couple. Yeah, and they had another one. The two tight ends. One of them plays Max Williams. Mm-hmm. Like they've had a couple of decent players during the Kill era. Unfortunately for Jerry Kill, he left because of health reasons. Right. It had nothing to do with his resume. He was a good coach.
Right.
You know, he built Northern Illinois to what it is. But okay. You know, with PJ Fleck, you know, I kind of felt more of a spot hire. You know, mm-hmm. And I don't know if he can really do it. Tyler Johnson's a good wide receiver, though.
Yeah, going to be interesting for Minnesota. But let's put a bow on the Big Ten, and let's wrap it up by giving us – you know, Greg, you mentioned earlier, I think you already called it Ohio State-Penn State is your game of the year.
It is.
I'm going to stick with Michigan-Ohio State. I think that last weekend of the season is going to be as impactful this year in the Big Ten as it's ever been. Andrew, what about you?
Wisconsin at Michigan.
Ooh, interesting. That is an interesting game because that would define – you know, really be an eliminator in terms of – you know, determining who really is a legitimate playoff contender and who isn't.
I wanted to say Michigan State, Ohio State, but that game they had last year just left a really bad taste in my mouth. Ohio State just killed them. Mm-hmm. You know,
it looked like the thing that kills me about Ohio State and Michigan when they've played the last 3 years, even in close games, when you watch the two teams on the field, it just doesn't look like Michigan's in the same athletic area as Ohio.
The only year when they had Peppers, Jabril Peppers, and
yes,
and it went to overtime. That was the one year where it's like, wow, Michigan's like right there with Ohio State. The other years, not so much. I agree.
Right. All right. So, Big Ten title game picks. Are we all going Ohio State, Wisconsin? Is that the unanimous selection?
I am.
Yes.
No. Actually, no. I'm not. let me raise my hand here. I think at some point, you've got Trace McSorley back. It has to happen for Penn State at some point in this rivalry. If not now, when? I think Penn State gets them this year, and I think Penn State edges out Ohio State and plays Wisconsin in the Big Ten Championship.
And you're taking Penn State to win that game?
No Joe Moorhead.
Let me get back to you. Come back to me at the end of you guys picking your championship game.
Ohio State, Wisconsin, and I think Ohio State, you know, like you watched that game last year. Score says it's a 10-point game, but physically on the field, it wasn't really – there's no comparison between those two teams. And I think that bears out again this year.
I'll give you
what Wisconsin does. I really do. But when push comes to shove, I don't think they can beat – a legitimate top 10 team in terms of talent. I don't think they can play with the Ohio States, Alabama's, Clemson's, you know, those teams. I just don't think they can.
I'll give you your 2018 Honey Badger Award. Andrew Van Ginkel at Wisconsin.
Okay.
Just gets nothing but sacks and interceptions and makes all the plays, so he's on all the highlights.
Okay. So and you're taking Ohio State to win the conference?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, they're just too talented.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like I keep saying, like, when they lose it, like, it's a surprise. And even in the, you know, I'm not trying to say the Big Ten is loaded, but they've assembled themselves well over the last 4 or 5 years. I know they get a lot of flack about their postseason lack of success, but I feel like, you know, I feel like Wisconsin has taken a step up. I don't know if it's when they beat you in Lambeau a couple of years ago, but it just feels like a different Wisconsin under Paul Chryst, if anybody else agrees.
And they won their bowl game, right?
They did. They waxed Miami. Yep. I mean, I know it says 34-20. It wasn't close, like Nick said about the Big Ten title game. Yep.
So, okay, I've made up my mind. I'm going to pick Penn State to win the championship game, but I'm a little nervous about that pick because they would have to beat Wisconsin twice this season. That's a little bit of an ask, but I think Penn State gets them. I just feel like this – at some point, Penn State's got to have something good. Listen, I'm not going to defend them off the field, but as far as the James Franklin led team, the football team, at some point the brakes have to start going their way in these situations. Because we've had a couple years in a row now where, but for a swing here or there, they could have very well been playing for the national championship.
Absolutely. Well, let's put a bow on the Big Ten and let's hop over to the Big 12, where I think a lot of people, if you look at a lot of playoff prognostications coming into this year in terms of...
Wait, hold on. Somebody just scored a touchdown. Okay, keep going.
If you look at a lot of the predictions for who's going to make the playoff, a lot of them seem to be edging towards having Big 12 left out of the playoff altogether this year. And it really feels like the narrative at this point is the conference's hopes are entirely dependent on Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a team that has a ton of talent on offense. There's no doubt about that. They're going to bring back a lot of talent, except for arguably the best player in school history in Baker Mayfield. Kyler Murray, I think the three of us got to see him a little bit more than the rest of the country did, being that he played at Texas A&M. I don't know that he is going to be as effective in a in that offense as a lot of people think. I think it relies on accuracy and timing and decision-making that I just didn't see out of him at Texas A&M. He got athleticism off the field. There's no doubt about that. But asking him to replace Baker Mayfield and be a legitimate, be the starter for a team that has playoff aspirations, I think that's too much of an ask.
And there's two things I think about with Kyler Murray. Number one, the post-Johnny Manziel quarterback carousel at Texas A&M under Sumlin was awful. And I don't know how much of the blame went on Sumlin and his offense. I don't know how much of it was just, the fact that maybe guys like Kyle Murray and Jokel and the other guy.
Kenny Hill?
And Knight, who they actually, ironically, got from Oklahoma. They weren't the guy. With a change of scenery might do something. The other thing is that Kyler Murray is an excellent baseball player, and he has $5 million waiting for him when he plays for the Oakland Athletics. So they basically had to do like a handshake deal where, like, after this season at Oklahoma, he is done. He's going into Major League Baseball. So this is a one-and-doner.
Yeah, your point stands, certainly, Nick, about replacing Baker Mayfield. I think he's – he was an exceptional college quarterback, one of the best college quarterbacks it feels like we say this here about a different guy, one of the greatest college quarterbacks we've ever seen, but certainly he put up the numbers to back that.
Say what you will about the pick, but he didn't go number one by accident.
No. Right. Here's the other thing to keep in mind about Kyler Murray. If he struggles, they've got a pretty touted guy behind him, a redshirt freshman named Austin Kendall. I'm sorry, redshirt sophomore named Austin Kendall. He was Mayfield's backup. And I don't think that he's going to, there's going to be a long leash for Kyler Murray because of his athleticism and his talent. But I think if something happens, they've got a guy that knows the system that's more of a traditional passer that they could put into that situation. And I will also say, Lincoln Riley, I don't throw this term around a lot. I think he is a brilliant offensive coach. I think he's might be the best offensive coach in football right now.
Yeah, it was. I mean, he reminds me of Chip Kelly when he was behind Bilotti at Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when Stoops left, it was like, oh, of course Lincoln Riley's the guy. That kind of business situation.
If it's not Oklahoma. I mean, let's assume that Oklahoma, something catastrophic happens to them. They're out of playoff contention. Who steps up in their absence? Who is the team challenging them in the Big 12? Somebody's got to play them in the championship game under Matt, where the top two make it. Like, somebody has to fill that second spot. And it feels like, to me, like the Big 12 – You know, usually in years past, Oklahoma State has been highly touted, a top 15, top 20 team coming into the year. Not so much this year with the departure of Mason Rudolph and all that. Texas still feels like they're getting their act together and aren't really ready to take that next step.
I feel like they're a year away from being really, really good.
Right.
I believe I'm the same boat, and I may die on this. I may die on this hill, but I believe in Tom Herman. I think he's a great coach. And
I felt like he was underhanded in how he got to Texas.
Absolutely, 100%.
But Sam Ellinger is really good. They're really building the defense. You know, they had a lot of good secondary players. I feel like that's sort of how they're building the team from the ground up. They're putting a lot of speed on the field in the defensive backfield, and they're going to just try to beat teams defensively with speed instead of offensively with speed, which is actually a good sort of counter to the rest of the Hurley-Dervish type of offense that you see in the Big 12, and we're going to talk about some other teams that are kind of still in that vein. Mm-hmm. Another one that sort of yangs to the yang in terms of defense is TCU.
TCU lost a lot this offseason. They lost their quarterback. They lost, like, I think six starters off defense, something like that.
Yeah, Kenny Trill's gone.
They lost a lot, but the thing about them is they are so consistently well coached every year by Gary Patterson. They're about the only team in conference that bothers to play defense.
And ever since they got Trayvon Boykin, the quarterback, a few years ago, their offense is never bad.
Great.
Never.
No, it's always good. So I think you have to, just on the basis of recent history, you have to put TCU in there as the top contender. But I think Texas could shock a lot of people this year because of they've done well with recruiting. I think Tom Herman's a great coach. And I know the trend, and we're going to get to this team. There's a lot of it have in the top 15, top 16, 17, West Virginia. I will be damned if I'm going to trust a Dana Holgorsen team.
I can't do it.
Here's where I am with West Virginia. I am going to pick them as probably the second best team in the Big 12, but that is more of the quality of the Big 12 this year than it is a glowing recommendation for West Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let's be clear. Will Greer is a really good quarterback.
Really good. He's
yeah, if he's
he would have
Florida.
He would have saved. He would have saved his job. Yeah.
Exactly. Him and McElwain would still be together, like having a latte. You know, they that was perfect. And then the drug suspension happened, you know, and it all fell apart. And then they got a guy, David Sills, who all he does is catch touchdowns. Mm-hmm. And Gary Jennings, Marcus Sims, really offense is really where it's at with West Virginia. But can their defense hold? That's a question with every Big 12 team outside of this year.
The beneficial thing for West Virginia is they're going to get Oklahoma at home. They're going to get Kansas State at home. They're going to get TCU at home. Their toughest road game is probably at Texas, which is November 3rd. But most of the top tier Big 10 or Big 12 teams this year have to go to Morgantown, which is the longest trip in the conference. So, again, I'm not sitting here saying I think West Virginia is really, really good. I just think they're a pretty good team in a conference that probably only has one legitimate contender in it.
And Mike Gundy always has really good teams that come out of Oklahoma State. Now, your mileage may vary on what you define as really good, but God, you lose Mason Rudolph and James Washington. Right. I mean, God, that reminds me of when they lost Brandon Whedon and Justin Blackman. It's like, yeah, you're good, but you're not as good as last year.
I'm going to make a prediction, Jay. I'm looking at their schedule, and based on how one of my coworkers, when I was at the newspaper, is a diehard West Virginia fan, so I became familiar with their pattern of football. And at the end of September, he's really happy. He's thinking, my gosh, this might be the year we contend for a championship. So I'm looking at their schedule right now. They're going to beat Tennessee. They're going to beat Youngstown. They're going to beat NC State. They're going to beat Kansas State. They're going to beat Texas Tech in like a 70-65 game that everyone's going to go nuts for. They're going to beat Kansas. They're going to go on the road undefeated and lose to Iowa State. And then they're going to beat Baylor at home. They're going to lose to Texas. They're going to lose to TCU. They're going to lose to Oklahoma State. They're going to lose to Oklahoma in a close game. And they're going to end up the same place they are every year.
Yeah. And let me tell you this: there's no shame in losing to Iowa State. Matt Campbell's
a not at all.
No, they did a huge bounce back last year.
Yeah,
they were absolutely. You know, we talked some Texas, we've talked some West Virginia, you know, Oklahoma. Obviously, are there any here that really catch your eye? Like Texas Tech God help them. They're so much fun to watch, but it just feels like they're never going to put it together. Man, it just
– I guess the one that is the fly in the ointment is Kansas State because they – it seems like every year, every year I write them off as if they're gonna plummet off the map.
They are
just
the
win 8 to 9 games every year.
They are the Northwestern of the Big 12. Right. Like, you know, it doesn't matter who's the coordinators behind Bill Snyder, who I guess will live forever. It doesn't matter which –
hopefully, knock on wood.
It doesn't matter what tall, strong, white quarterback they get that can kind of run and doesn't throw the ball a lot but has good efficiency. It doesn't matter which one they have. It doesn't matter which good return specialist they have or which good offensive line they have. They just always find a way to grind out 2 or 3 wins that you didn't expect.
Right.
And they could score points, you know, because you have to in the Big 12. That's just the nature of the beast. So.
All right, so under this actually, before we get to the championship game of the year in the Big 12, I stick by it. I'm going to say Oklahoma at West Virginia, November 23rd, Black Friday this year. Going to have a little bit of a high-quality, some Big 12 action to watch as you're doing your Thanksgiving shopping.
I don't think any of these games will really have huge ramifications nationally except, you know, obviously if Oklahoma stumbles somewhere along the way. So I'm going to pick for my game of the year what I think will be the most exciting game of the year, and I'm going to pick that Texas Tech and West Virginia game on September 29th at Tech. I think it's going to be, like I said, 70 to 65, somewhere in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I'll be watching.
I'll go with Red River.
Okay.
That'll be a good one.
That's the conventional pick. All right, this wacky championship game format where the top two teams make it guaranteed rematch. Oklahoma versus who? I'm going to say West Virginia.
I can't do it. I'll go with TCU again.
TCU. Greg?
Give me Texas.
Oh, that would be fun. Oklahoma-Texas for the Big 12 title would be a lot of fun. I would be completely into that.
Let me ask you this. Do you think it's more enjoyable that you can just kind of pick out of the pool? Do you think the other conferences should copy that?
The only thing I don't like about it – so let's assume for a moment that my pick of Oklahoma-West Virginia turns out to be accurate. That means if that happens, they turn around and play again 8 days later. I don't like that. Like, that's the one aspect of it I don't like. It would be like Auburn and Alabama turning around and playing again 7 days after the Iron Bowl. You know what I mean?
I think conferences would like it, but I don't think teams that would like to protect their resume would like it.
Right.
You know?
Go ahead, Greg.
Oh, yeah. I was just saying, I'm of two minds about it because on the one hand, I am probably the biggest proponent in all of sports of removing divisions and just going with the best teams to play each other in playoff formats. But I think in college, a little bit different because, as Nick pointed out, the timing element of it, a lot of conferences it won't matter. But something like Alabama and Auburn, that wouldn't happen either. So I think if you schedule it out properly, it would be okay. The Big 12, it's a little bit different because you don't have those division rivalries turn around and play each other again. It's kind of a weird situation. I think it makes more sense if you're trying to be fair about who the best teams are. But on the other hand, you also have a situation where your conference's only hope for the playoff mm-hmm. has to beat their rival twice.
And also you have less teams, so you're playing everybody. It's like in basketball, it's a round robin.
Right.
You can't. There's nowhere to hide in the Big 12.
Mm-hmm. With the SEC, at least you have the potential of not playing one of the other top tier teams if you went to that format.
Very true. And as much as fan bases would like to scoff that off, that's a legitimate concern. You don't want to have too tough of a schedule. You don't want to play where every team comes off of a bye before you play them.
Nobody wants the Notre Dame schedule.
No.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that's actually something we will talk about in the back half of the show. Well, guys, let's take a break right here. And when we come back, we're going to dive into the Pac-12. We're going to finally get to our beloved SEC. And then we're just going to talk about, you know, the national and generally talk about some of the top tier non-conference games, Heisman Trophy contenders, and our playoff picks for the 2018 season. So stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Police Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Back, Place to Be Nation Pop, dedicated listeners of the brand new Place to Be Nation Sports Network. Welcome back to the second half of the Place to Be Nation College Football Preview. I, of course, am Nick Duke, along with me, as you heard in the first half, Greg Phillips and Andrew Reich. We're taking you through conference as we take a look at what we think is going to happen in the upcoming 2018 college football season. So let's keep this thing rolling along and let's move out west. And let's talk a little Pac-12 after dark. I got to be honest, guys. This is probably the conference I'm the least educated on coming into this. But we can give it the old college try less.
For those fans of sleep, we all are.
Yeah, it sucks because I feel like, you know, I always catch some Pac-12 stuff. You know, like when you wake up on a morning, they'll be re-airing a Pac-12 game or something on like ESPNU at like 9 in the morning, and I'll always catch a little bit of it, and I'm like, man, this is a really good game. I wish I would have stayed up to watch this, but I never
do. They sort of have a habitat on the back end of the doubleheader on the Deuce on Saturday nights, but it's sort of that wind down where kind of finished up with the Big Ten game of the week and the most of the SEC, even though they have a new schedule where most SEC games kind of like the last one ends like super late, like somewhere around 11 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And by that point, like the Mountain game has started or the Pac-12 game has started, and you know, they got some interesting teams in the back in the Pac-12. It's just a matter of, you know, how legitimate can they be? Because we really haven't seen one since Oregon when they had Mariota.
Right. Well, Washington made the playoff a couple of years ago, and I think that's a testament to the job that Chrisman has done with that program. He's a guy that, you know, going back to his Boise State days, man, he's a dude that you got to, you know, when he has time to prepare for people and scheme something up, he's dangerous. I mean,
I'll just say it right up front. Auburn's in trouble.
I tend to agree with that. I mean, like, I trust me, I was there when a Chris Peterson-led team played Georgia in one of those opening kickoff games in Atlanta, and we got our heads kicked in by Boise State. And Washington's got better athletes than Boise State ever did.
You, me, and Greg have talked about this before. The 2011 Boise State Broncos is the greatest Group of Five team of all time. Like, that team was, like, legitimately great. They just so happened to play in a year when Alabama was great, LSU was great, Stanford had Andrew Luck. It was going to be really hard to get in.
Right.
And that was the BCS era.
Yeah, where you had to be in the top two, where no Group of Five team was ever going to make it, ever.
The Marcus Lawrence, I think Doug Martin was still there, Kellen Moore was there, Austin Pettis, Titus Young. It's an incredible Group of Five team.
But yeah, I kind of think the discussion in the Pac-12 starts with Washington. Now you can make some arguments for USC, and you know, how good is JT Daniels going to be there, and is it good enough to really get USC back to where they, you know, where that program is expected to be year in and year out? But I don't know. I'm kind of still looking at Washington and going, I feel like they're the team to beat, and I think they're going to show that week 1 against Auburn.
USC's got a really hard schedule to navigate.
And they're here. I mean, USC, because the Pac-12 plays a 9-game conference schedule and USC has the annual game against Notre Dame plus a game against Texas, that is a murderer's round.
At Stanford, Texas, home against Washington State.
On a Friday.
On a Friday. At Utah, which is never an easy place to play.
Right.
And then at UCLA, in what Chip Kelly is the game that he's probably going to be coaching for all year long, waiting for, and then home against game to end the season. That is a murderer's row of opposition. Now, granted, you have, because it's the Pac-12 and it's very top heavy, you have your, you know, for lack of a better term, your Colorado, Arizona. Well, you could argue Arizona, but Oregon State, Cal, but. You know, that's a tough schedule. I don't know. I don't see how they get through that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, JT Daniels, come on down.
And one team that you didn't mention, Greg, on that murderer's row that I think we need to talk about, that I think is unquestionably, in my view, the sleeper in the Pac-12 this year, Arizona, with Kevin Sumlin, Khalil Tate at quarterback, what he did. Mm-hmm. I look at Khalil Tate and his skill set, and I'm not saying he's as talented as Johnny Manziel. You pair him in that in Kevin Sumlin offense, I think that is a dangerous combination for the rest of the Pac-12 South.
He is the definition of Pac-12 after dark.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the guy who's like, oh my God, what happened there? Did somebody get played? And he's got like 1,000, he's got like 200 yards rushing and 250 yards passing, and he's got 5 touchdowns. Yeah. It's just one of those things. And yeah, you know, he had fostered Johnny Manziel when he was at A&M. You know, some people think, oh, maybe he can capture the magic. The other thing about Arizona is that they bring back 9 defensive players.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know. They gave up 34 points a game, so I don't know if those are the kind of players you want to bring back.
Especially to a Kevin Sumlin team that has never played defense, ever. Not once.
Yeah, so we'll see. But, you know, and Utah is just scrappy.
You're right.
Like, they just always are in the hunt, you know.
Oh, yeah. They're Utah is going to be well-coached. They're gonna compete in games, but they're also – you know, and I'm a fan of that program, but they always tend to – they have a shot to win Pac-12 at win their division every year, mm-hmm. and they always slip up somewhere in that later portion of the season.
And this is our obligatory special teams mention. Utah, first-team All-American punter and kicker.
Yep, absolutely.
There you go.
Yes, that can matter.
I'm familiar with their punter because he beat out J.K. Scott. So
Matt Gay, he won the Groza Award.
We haven't talked about you mentioned Khalil Tate. I don't think there's an argument to be made. He's not even the best player conference though offensively because Stanford brings back a 2,000-yard rusher in Bryce Love, who is a different kind of running back than we're used to seeing at Stanford, right? We're used to that Toby Bruiser. Bryce Love is a burner,
right?
An absolute burner. Stanford, you know what? For as their early struggles last year, you know they ended on a 2-game losing streak, obviously. But I feel like you know they have their issues every year at quarterback. They always do. They don't have a good passing game.
They do have their quote-unquote guy this time in KJ Costello. Mm-hmm. So
theoretically. So we'll see how it works out. But they're going to have a great running net. They're going to have looking at this, probably the best defense in the Pac-12. Again, well, them and Washington will have the two best defenses in the Pac-12. You know, they're stuck in the same division as Washington. But I think this is as far as national ramifications, this conference is a two-team race, Stanford and Washington to me. But I think that within divisional championships, yes, Arizona could push USC. Mm-hmm. I think who knows what Chip Kelly's going to do in year one at UCLA. It could be better than we're all expecting. And then, of course, the mad scientist is out there at Washington State. So he's going to beat some of these teams that we think are great. Probably Washington.
And you know what's funny about Washington State? They've been winning with defense for the last year.
Yeah.
Now they lose Luke Falk, which is huge. So we'll see how they kind of evolve this year.
They'll also lose Luke Falk's 475 interceptions. So
that's a fair point. But you know, Reese actually kind of alluded to this earlier when we were talking about Willie Taggart. I don't think we need to sleep on Oregon. I don't think Oregon can win the Pac-12 North or win the conference title, but I think they are back on the right track, and I think Mario Cristobal is going to be able to carry forward some of that momentum that Willie Taggart helped to build. And I think they're those teams. It's going to be a thorn in the side of the Washingtons and Stanfords and Washington States of the world. And I think it just makes that Pac-12 North that much more difficult to navigate.
Yeah, they were in the South where one time Colorado won it. I could see that happening. You know, but definitely not in the North. That's a little bit too much.
By the way, not to besmirch Mr. Falk, he didn't throw that many interceptions, honestly. It's just, I'm looking at it, he threw 13 last year, but I'm looking at it, and it felt like did it not feel like they came in bulk?
I think half of them was against Cal.
Yeah. And I feel like every game I watched them play in, the rare occasions I got to see them play, it was Falk throwing two or three picks in each game.
And to wheel back to Stanford, they also probably have the best backup running back in the country in Cameron Scarlett.
No doubt.
I
think Stanford could have won their bowl game if they had sat the injured Bryce Love because he was playing hurt.
Yeah, against TCU.
Yeah, and played him more. I think they win that game because I thought he was the more effective back in that game.
It's going to be interesting for Stanford. It definitely is. I think Bryce Love is one of the legitimate Heisman Trophy contenders. And like you said, Greg, it seems like it's probably a two-team race of what he has walked into in terms of running a college program and having to recruit and do things like that. This is a really, really weird fit. And they retained the bulk of their staff. They fired their head coach and brought back almost their entire, you know, assistant coaching staff. What's the thought process behind that?
I don't know, but no, I do know they bring back their best quarterback and their best receiver, but they lose that two-headed monster they had at running back, including the guy that had like 9 touchdowns against Texas Tech. I always forget his name, but I just know him as the guy who had 9 touchdowns against Texas Tech.
Rashard?
It was DeMario. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The Blake Barnett era did not last at Arizona State, sadly.
No, it did not. Okay, Pac-12, like we said, we're kind of limited in what we'll discuss there. But let's go game of the year. Has to be Stanford-Washington, right? And I believe that game is played, played at Washington on November 3rd. And that's kind of what I'm looking at.
And that loss by Washington was the one that cost them, and it wound up being Stanford and USC in the Pac-12 game instead of Washington. So.
Right.
Yep. I think that's your game of the year in the Pac-12. Virtually without question. Just to add one to the scenario that's not just going to be Washington, I will look at one of these USC games and I will say You know, let's go USC and UCLA. Interesting to see.
Just for the sauce. Yeah.
Just what happens there. So Pac-12 go ahead. Go ahead, Andrew.
I was just going to say about Washington, just to finish up, is that you kind of wonder when the eroding starts to where they sort of even back out, you know, with Chris Peterson and Washington. Here's the thing I think people don't understand about Washington is that, you know, the 2016 team, the one that got to the playoff, that was a really, really good team, of course. And they lost some guys to the NFL, specifically in the secondary. Then this year they lost Pettis and lost, you know, Berea and Vita Villa and Azeem Victor. And you're thinking, oh, okay, it's eroding. But here's the truth with Washington. They still haven't lost that yet.
No.
Like, there's still some gas in that tank.
They're going to need – if Washington's going to get where they want to get and where they have the capability of getting, they're going to need Browning to play better than he did last year, though.
Yeah, and Miles Gaskin's going to have to replace Pettis as, like, your go-to guy. You can't rely on, like, Hunter Bryan and, like, a kind of, like, random receiver number two to do it. But the defense – they gave up 17 points a game – in 2016, you got playoff. They gave up 16 points a game, less than 300 yards last year. They bring back 9 starters. Now, I know they lose Villa, and I knew they lose some of the big boys up front, but that's still a really good defense.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at. I look at them, and I think they're the most balanced team in the Pac-12. And I know that you can look at Stanford and say it's really good, you know, defensively as well, and they have Bryce Love. But I look at Washington, and I look at Browning, and I think they can be effective passing the ball, running the ball, playing defense. I mean, I think they're just really good at every facet of the game.
And just to bounce off my point about Browning, as good as he's been in college, he's been extremely efficient. The problem is he dropped from 43 touchdown passes in 16 to 19 in 17. So he's got to get that back up, I think, if they're going to be a national title contender.
They're going to know fast because we talked about the Auburn game in Atlanta. Poor Auburn. They're going to play in Atlanta forever.
Given the outcomes of their last two games in Atlanta, Andrew, I hope they play every game in Atlanta the rest of their existence.
Amen. And the Friars. The
cupcake against North Dakota at Utah. So we're going to know fast.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. So Pac-12 title game. Who are you guys got? I'm going to say I'm going to go out on the limb and I'm going to take Arizona to face off against Washington in the Pac-12 title game, and I'm going to pick Washington as my back champ.
Oh, this conference is so crazy sometimes. I'll live life dangerously and I will say Stanford and USC.
Which is the same exact one as last year.
Yeah.
Stanford and Utah.
Ooh. This is going to be the year Utah gets over the hump.
Yeah, well, I mean, USC, like you said.
They have this dangerous
curvature where it's like they're good, but they don't look good against certain teams. And, you know, I know the Texas game has no bearing on the standings in the conference, but, I mean, I can see them dropping a few games here. And that UCLA game was – because – I don't know how good UCLA really is yet. I've heard from Bruce Feldman's report that they're really not there yet talent-wise. Kelly, he's a very good coach.
Right. That's one team we didn't really talk about a lot, and that's probably one of the more intriguing teams in the conference is what is UCLA this year under Chip Kelly? And I kind of tend to have that view where I don't know that they're going to be that good, but I think you look at the landscape of the Pac-12, and especially you look at the landscape of the Pac-12 South, and I don't think it's out of the question that 3 years from now, Chip Kelly is running the Pac-12 South much the same way he ran the Pac-12 North at Oregon.
Yeah, or it could be Rich Rod just be another guy, you know?
Could be. I don't know. I think I have more faith in Chip Kelly than I ever did in Rich Rodriguez, put it that way.
Yeah.
But I have faith in David Shaw. That team, Stanford's good.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So your Pac-12 title game?
Mine is Stanford and Utah.
Stanford and Utah, that's right. And you're taking Stanford to win that game, of course.
Yeah, I'll pick Stanford.
So we're all picking the Pac-12 North champion. Like basically, yes. It's Washington, Stanford, and you know, whoever comes out of the South is the sacrificial
lamb.
They're
the two best teams in the conference.
Right.
Easily, yeah. If they were in different divisions, they would 100% be meeting in the championship game, at least based on what we know now.
Awesome. Well, here we go. Let's move on to the main event of the evening, what I'm sure precisely 6 or 7 of you have come here to listen to, and that's the three of us dig in to the SEC, the Southeastern Conference. And this is one where I think we can afford a little bit of a deeper dive. So let's kind of take this division by division, and let's start in the lesser of the two divisions, that of course being the SEC East.
Or should you say the SEC least?
I'm fine with the I got Michigan calling it the SEC least. That no issue whatsoever. I'll just go ahead and say it, and you know, there's always an element of not wanting to jinx yourself, and I know Greg feels,
right.
But
yeah,
it really, like, there is no reason that Georgia shouldn't dominate this division again. I mean, you look at the turmoil at Florida and Tennessee. You look at the talent disparity between Georgia and South Carolina, who is most frequently mentioned as their biggest contender. And then the other team I look at, I point to that kind of would scare me a little bit, would be Missouri if they hadn't replaced Josh Heupel, an air raid spread principle offensive coordinator, with Derek Dooley as offensive coordinator, and they're going to go to more conventional pro-style sets, which doesn't fit their personnel, and is like trying to fit a square peg of Drew Locke into a round hole.
I guess they feel like, you know, they think it's similar like Lane Kiffin when he went to Alabama. The difference is Lane Kiffin was actually successful at Alabama.
Right.
Like I don't know about Derek Dooley. Sorry, it just feels weird.
The whole division just, you know, Georgia is under Kirby Smart recruiting at a level that the school has never seen before, honestly. Not even at the peak of the Mark Richt era. I think the best Mark Richt ever finished in terms of national recruiting rankings was 1 year. He had a class that finished third. Kirby has not finished worse than third in any of his three recruiting classes to this point. The talent on campus is stacked in a way that it never has been before, and they play in a down division. And
now they lose a lot.
They lose a lot on defense.
You lose two of your probably 5 or 10 best running backs of all time. You lose your top receiver. You lose Roquan Smith, who is an awesome defensive player
right.
for them.
Right. They're definitely
cupboard is still stacked.
There are definitely gaps, but it's gotten to a point.
They're not going
to
lose anything at running back, in my opinion.
That's been the thing that I've wanted to bring up with everyone who has said that, and like, let's just be honest. The Nick Chubb of the last 2 years, as good as he was not the same Nick Chubb that he was pre-knee injury. To the point where by the end of the year last year, anybody who watched Georgia would tell you Sony Michel was the best player on the best running back on that team, and it wasn't
the best one in the Rose Bowl.
Wasn't particularly close. And if he hadn't gotten hurt in the national championship, God knows. I mean, like, he was by far the only real effective running back against Alabama in that game. But
he was scary. He had this kind of explosiveness that scared
me. I called Sony Michel the sideline killer. If he got to you were in trouble. You remind me.
Oh yeah, he was Kenyon Drake. He was a bigger, stronger Kenyon Drake.
And they've got a guy now, I mean, who played last year. And granted, I don't think he's as powerful and doesn't break tackles as well as Sony Michel. But if you want to talk about an absolute burner, DeAndre Swift is everything Sony Michel was.
Ask Auburn in the SEC championship. Yes, he is.
Beautiful.
They also got a top running back coming in, Zamir White.
Yeah, Zamir White. The thing about Zamir White is he tore his ACL midway through his high school season last year. But from all indications, the reports out of camp are that he is enjoying and described as an Adrian Peterson-like recovery to the point where he was running around without a knee brace this week at practice. So he's expected to be cleared to go when the season opens. Now, how healthy is he actually? Is that burst going to be there? We don't know. And plus, there's a transition from high school to college. The running back that I think you need to get on for Georgia to kind of slot into that number two spot is Elijah Holyfield, the son of Evander Holyfield. Hasn't played a ton at Georgia to this point, but he's really good. He's really powerful. The dude is a physical specimen, and will be given the biggest opportunity to be that number two guy. Because much like Alabama, which is the model that Kirby is following, they're not going to give one guy 30 carries in a game. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. The worry is the defensive part, but let's just stay with the offense here when we talk about Georgia. Okay. You got Swift. You got Zamir White. James Cook is another guy. Mm-hmm. Your kick returner is Hardman, who's really good. Terry Godwin really came on late. Riley Ridley, who's Calvin Ridley's brother, is back. He had a good national title game performance. And then they got a guy that's kind of in that Mike Gesicki type of mold as a tight end in Isaac Nada. Not as much of a blocker as he is a pass-catching type of tight end.
And then also, you know, we got to wait. We're still waiting on an NCAA ruling. The kid from Cal, Demetrius Robertson, who 2 years ago was considered the top athlete prospect in the state of Georgia, who wound up playing wide receiver at Cal, has applied for a hardship waiver to be allowed to – he's already transferred to Georgia and is applying, you know, to the NCAA to be allowed to play immediately. They have approved a lot of hardship transfer waivers this year. The feeling is that they're probably going to rule in his favor, and if that happens, that adds another dimension to this team in terms of speed on the outside.
Yeah, and they lose, they win, but they bring back the rest of the offensive line in terms of starters. And then you know you're stacked at quarterback.
Yeah, good, you can tell, real good problem at quarterback.
You can tell Jacob Eason to go ahead and take a hike, a good quarterback, to go ahead and just kind of step out because you have Jake Fromm who came in, and then you bring in one of the best quarterbacks coming out, Justin Fields.
And Justin Fields is going to bring something to the offense that's just a completely new dynamic. I mean, Kirby said at SEC Media Days, there's no way we're redshirting this kid. He's going to play. I mean, they're going to have packages designed for him, short yardage, goal line, to take advantage of his skills as a runner, but he can also sling the ball. So, I mean, there are going to be opportunities for him to come in and play, but I don't think it's a full-on quarterback controversy the way you see on the other side of the conference with the other, you know, juggernaut at Alabama. So, yeah, and defensively, absolutely, there are some concerns. I think the defensive line winds up being the biggest concern. I like the starters, Tyler Clark, you know, Tyler Clark anchoring the middle and stuff like that, but depth is a concern on the defensive line, which we know is a big deal in the SEC. Secondary-wise, you lose Dominic Sanders, of course, in the linebacking core, Lorenzo Carter, and Roquan Smith. But
I was gonna say, in the secondary, they're fine. They still got J.R. Reed and DeAndre Baker,
yes.
They're okay. They'll be right.
Yeah, but the thing, they recruited so well. The thought process is, if you're going to get them, you need to get them early, and I think that's why a lot of people are pointing to that South Carolina game in week two as probably the biggest question mark on the schedule or the biggest opportunity for somebody to knock them off, because by midseason, with the talent they have, these kids are going to become more and more comfortable, and it's going to become increasingly difficult for anybody to beat them. And let's be honest, the schedule for Georgia sets up really nicely this year.
I don't think that Florida game is going to be a walk. I do think Dan Mullen installing his coaching staff there is actually like one of those ones where it might be right place, right time.
Yeah, and the thing is, no Georgia-Florida game is ever going to be as easy as the Georgia-Florida game last year was, where that was a perfect storm of circumstances where Florida is their season on the field is starting to unravel a little bit, and then Jim McElwain loses his mind and starts accusing people of you know, levying death threats at him. It never happened. And it was just this weird, you know, bizarre, perfect storm of circumstances that led to Florida getting their heads kicked in. No, that Florida game is not a walk in the park. I guess I'm looking at it from the standpoint of they're going to be favored in every game they play. And outside of the true road games at South Carolina, at Missouri, at LSU, none of the other games really terrify me.
And I don't worry at all about their defense. They are building themselves to be Alabama East. Kirby is recruiting to be Alabama East, offensive line, defense heavy. They're going to be fine. And you're going to have inexperience that's going to happen every year, because increasingly you're going to have more and more of these Georgia defensive players, really, because they're really, really good, and they're going to be replaced by outstanding freshmen that take their spots.
And what impressed me too is that, like, I mean, this is the 2018 college football preview. It's not the 2017 college football preview, but that Rose Bowl, I mean, just a wonderful game. But like, it shows, like, I mean, I'm not trying to say that like, Jake Fromm is like the next Baker Mayfield, but it's like this team can actually score when they need to. Yeah. You know, it didn't seem like that all the time. You know, against Auburn, even in the SEC championship game, it seemed like a bit of us to try to move the ball. Mm-hmm. But if you play a bad defense, I forget the guy's name, the offensive coordinator. He's been in the SEC forever.
Oh, Jim Chaney.
Jim Chaney. Yeah. He knows how to do it. He was at that ball against Alabama in the national championship game. So
in the first half.
Offensively, very creative. A lot of starters coming back. And like, you know, like Greg is saying, you have five starters only coming back on defense, but Alabama always has like four or five or maybe even three starters coming
back.
Three
this year, yeah.
And the wheel just keeps on turning. So
offensive line is probably the aspect of this team I'm most excited to watch. Yes, you lose Isaiah Wynn. You replace him with a former five-star in Isaiah Wilson. This is going to be the biggest offensive line Georgia has ever had. and probably and you know, granted, you can't go too much off of recruiting, but if you just look at recruiting rankings and stuff like that, this is going to be the most talented offensive line Georgia has ever had by a pretty wide margin.
And philosophically, that is the most important recruiting target for the system that Kirby wants to run. It, 100% in Alabama, they believe in the lines on both sides of the ball, and that's just – every Saban disciple is going to be that way.
And we have to put an official – like, we have to put a Place to Be Nation official embargo on Jake from State Farm jokes. Like, we have to stop it before it gets worse.
Yeah, that did – I mean, that's – yeah.
See, as somebody who watched all, or you know, to listen or watched all their games, I will take Jake from State Farm jokes over. Fun fact about Jake Fromm: did you know he played in the Little League World Series? And it's mentioned on every telecast for the entire season. It is.
Did you know that Jerome Bettis is from Detroit?
Just the worst. You know, that's you know, my own little deep dive into Georgia. But what about the other teams in the East? I mean, everybody seems to be pointing at South Carolina. I got to be honest, I don't see it. Like, I think South Carolina was bad defensively last year. I don't think they're going to be that much better. And offensively, yeah, they get Deebo Samuel after that injury, but is he going to be the same player he was coming off the injury? And they were not good on the offensive line and haven't been good on the offensive line under Will Muschamp.
They play Clemson at the end of every year. Clemson embarrassed them in South Carolina last year.
Right.
And I'm not trying to say like, oh, South Carolina is trying to prove that they belong type of thing. I think people knew that it was year two of a 4 or 5 year kind of plan. And they're doing fine under Muschamp, you know, Coach Boone. But it's like, really? Like, you really think they're going to make – like, I just don't see it. I think it's still Florida.
Look at that Florida offense last year in 2017 that was so reviled under Jim McElwain. I read the other day, I don't remember what the exact numbers are, but it's like South Carolina only averaged something like 7 yards a game more than Florida did last year. It's not like South Carolina is bringing back a bunch of skill players from an offense that was really good.
And they're bringing in a first-time offensive coordinator in Brian McClendon, who was upgraded for receivers coach.
Yep.
To my knowledge, hasn't called plays before.
Actually, he called plays in the Tax Slayer Bowl win Georgia over Penn State after Mark Rick
when
expired.
They didn't have a coach. Yeah.
Yep, he was the interim head coach and called plays in that game. So that is the one game.
Still unproven. And you know, I get it. I understand it because I think Muschamp's you know what you're getting with him. You're getting a hard-nosed coach. A stubborn coach. I don't want to say a good head coach because I don't think he's proven that. But I think he's going to certainly have a defense that will compete, if not be good. And I think they're going to have some exciting offensive plays at times. But I just, you know, it shocks me that they won last year, to be honest. I didn't realize it. I'm looking at their record now.
Yeah.
It just surprises me. But I think ultimately, Nick, you asked what do we have to say about the other teams in this division. I don't think there's one. I think it's a collection of average teams.
I think Florida.
One thing to say.
Okay.
I think Tennessee's got a way to go.
Oh. Yeah. I think
that was a very hard fall that they had under Butch Jones.
Yes, I think Tennessee they're in for a tough. Look at the schedule. West Virginia to open the year. I think West Virginia kills them. I really do, and I know that's giving maybe a little bit too much credit to West Virginia.
They always lose to Florida.
Into this 5-game stretch for Tennessee to open conference play, home against Florida, at Georgia, at Auburn, home against Alabama, at South Carolina.
Five. And they get the poo-poo platter.
5 weeks. They could easily lose all five of those games by 2 touchdowns or more. I mean, it's just going to be a brutal road back for them for a little while. But Florida, you know, you brought that up, Andrew. And my only thing with Florida is I think Dan Mullen will – there's no way they're going to be worse than they were a year ago. Let's go ahead and throw that out there.
Impossible.
Yeah. But I know he's a quarterback whisperer or a quarterback guru or whatever you want to call him. But Felipe Franks is just not – he's not the guy. And I don't know that that's going to get – that situation is going to get a whole lot better. You have somebody that can really run that offense.
There's one thing Dan Mullen's very well known for, building good offensive lines,
right?
Big, strong ones. And they have everybody coming back, including Martez Ivey. Mm-hmm. Now, the defense at Florida has never been a problem. No matter who the head coach was, no matter who the DC was, it never is a problem. I think they bring in Todd Grantham now because he had come into Mississippi State, and mm-hmm. then he followed Mullen to Mississippi State. Mm-hmm. He's kind of known, and you know this from the Georgia days, he's known as like a blitz-happy type of coordinator. So we'll see what they do with Jabari Zuniga and CeCe Jefferson and David Reese and CJ Henderson. Like, they still got – I mean, Florida has never had a trouble getting talent. Let's just be honest.
Well, they've and always that's actually,
had talent players.
That's actually a little bit of a something that has been their downfall over the last few years. You look at Florida, and they've recruited under McElwain – top 15, top 20 in the country. And you look at that number and you go, hey, top 15, top 20 in the country. That's pretty good. But you look at the rest of the SEC, they've routinely been sixth or seventh in the conference in recruiting the last several years. And I think as you see that Muschamp talent now that he recruited defensively is all gone for the most part. Mm-hmm. I think they are going to start to feel a little bit of a crunch when it comes to talent, especially when you compare them to Georgia, who's recruiting at a higher level than ever before. Texas now has come in under Jimbo Fisher and is starting to recruit very well. Alabama obviously is recruiting at a level that is the gold standard in college football. And Auburn is recruiting. I mean, Florida has got to pick it up on the recruiting trail to really get back to where they want to be.
And I think we're going to have to wait another year to see what Mullen can do in that standpoint, because the thing is, let's be honest, that campus, that location, mm-hmm. Gainesville, that should be a minimum top recruiting location every year.
Should be, but has it been the last couple of years is the point.
It's a more attractive area than Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. It should be neck and neck with Miami in that regard. It should not be difficult to recruit there.
And that's why Mullen was a perfect fit. He brings that offensive sex appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it hasn't been that hotbed in the last few years. But I think they'll be better this year. I think they'll be, nick up the air. I do think they'll probably make a bowl game this year. They should. I mean, they shouldn't have been as bad as they were last year. That was just ridiculous. Tennessee, they're going to be better. I think they're going to be one or two games better, but they're going to be better, and I think it's going to start defensively because I do think Pruitt will get their defense. If not, it's not going to be where he wants it to be, but it's going to be – he's never gone anywhere and not improved the defense.
Yeah, and he brings in Charles Kelly, who was – I think he was the room coach when he left at Florida State. So he brings him in, and then he brought in his linebacker coach at Georgia. So.
And that's a fair point. They'll be better, but they were 0-8 in the conference last year. So it's not like horrible. Better is going to be
it all sideways after the Florida Hail Mary loss.
I think they can beat Kentucky. They can beat Vandy, but I think those are probably the only two conference games they can win.
I disagree with you. I think they can. I think they'll knock off one of the average trio of South Carolina, Missouri, and Florida.
This is my hot take for the SEC East. I think the Kentucky ride is over. Like I know.
Don't
a lot of people,
say that, please.
I'm a lot of people are just saying, Mark Stoops, he's kind of gaining momentum. I think it's going to bottom out.
I agree with you, but I hope you're wrong, and here's why. Every single Troy football fan that there is rooting for Kentucky, or should be rooting for Kentucky to have a winning season this year and to contend for the SEC. Well, they're not going to contend for the SEC East, but every single fan wants Kentucky to finish second in that division this year, because if Kentucky does bad and the wheels fall off and Stoops gets fired, Neil Brown will be the Kentucky head next year.
Oh, look at you with your local yokel fears. Look at you. Me and David Rand over on my end. We'll talk about him in a second.
Before we leave the SEC East behind, one more team I want to talk about. That's Missouri. I alluded to it earlier. You look at them offensively, tons of skill players back. Drew Lock is probably legitimate. He and Stidham are probably the two guys you point at and go, those are the two pro-ready prospects in terms of quarterback in the conference. But I can't stress how much I hate that Derek Dooley hire for the talent they have on the field. If they had Josh Heupel coming back, I would view them as the clear-cut number two team in the SEC East and a legitimate contender to knock Georgia off, at least. Maybe not to win the division, but Georgia's got to go at Missouri at the end of September. But with that Derek Dooley hire and them trying to transition to more of an offense, I just don't think it's going to work. I think it is taking away what has set them apart and made them unique and what has been the only real strength of their team the last few years. I think it was an abysmal hire.
And here's the funny part about it is that, like, when you have a guy like Drew Locke in offense that seems to be kind of ready-made, when you lose a guy like Heupel, you want like a quarterback coddler. You look, one of those guys that maybe has been not a guru, like Noel Noni or whatever his name is, like somebody like that who always gets that kind of airplay. Here's the funny part about Derek Dooley. He's never been a quarterback's coach in his career.
Nope.
He was a wide receivers coach with the Cowboys after his Tennessee days were over. Now listen, their wide receiver core, Jonathan Johnson, Emmanuel Hall, I'm going to screw this dude's name, Albert Akwunobom. Did I get it?
I think something like that.
I believe it's Aquaman, actually.
Aquaman. Oh, yeah. Only in theaters something November. Their receiving core is excellent. And they bring pretty much all of them back for Drew Locke to throw to, and their running backs are really good. And the offense is going to be cooking. That's the weird thing about Missouri is that they sort of stand out in that way, and it kind of came out of nowhere last year. No one really saw that coming with their offense.
No, they didn't. And again, you know, they carried so much momentum over offensively that I don't understand that Derek Dooley hire. So we'll see how they turn out. I think we're all in agreement. It's Georgia and a bunch of question marks in the East. Now in the West, I think there are more proven teams, but I think it is as definitive as it ever is in the West. Yes, I know Auburn won the West last year. I get that. But I'm going to view, I'll be honest, I think it was
Say that again?
Auburn won the West last year, and I think it was a fluke. I think Alabama's the class of that division. I think they've been the class of that division for a few years now. But since LSU kind of had their decline, it kind of left this void for a challenger to Alabama that nobody has really filled to this point, at least in terms of a challenger to Alabama. So, Greg, you know, I'll kind of turn the floor over to you here, much the same way I took it over for Georgia. And I think it all starts, I mean, where everybody wants to talk about is this quarterback situation.
Yeah, so I guess I'll lead off, or should I save that for last? No, I'll lead off with that because that's the most interesting thing everybody wants to know. Is it going to be Tua? Is it going to be Jalen?
It's going to be Tua. Right?
Oh, man, very Cardale Jones, JT Barrett-y, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah,
it is. Okay, so I want to lead this segment off because I'm an Alabama fan, and Alabama fans have a bit of a reputation for a reason. But I believe, and I have felt for a long time, that I am embarrassed with the treatment that Jalen Hurts gets from Alabama fans at times. For a guy that has been as good as he has not had a single field incident, has not had any kind of academic issues. He's been an incredible student. He's been an incredible leader to his teammates. He's been popular in the locker room. He's put his head down, and he's done everything he's been asked to do. He has been an outstanding player for Alabama. He's been an outstanding quarterback for Alabama. And my premise here is that people need to lay off of him and quit acting like he's not done anything and that this shouldn't be a conversation, because the kid's done a lot. He has done a ton at Alabama, and he provides an element to the offense that, okay, he's not going to be playing on Sundays at quarterback, just not going to happen. But in college, you can win playing the style of football that Jalen Hurts does, and it gives you a different element than any other quarterback you could have on that roster. Here's the problem, and here's the reason why I do think it's going to be – and to answer the conundrum here, I think it's going to be a combination. But Tua is going to be the 1A, and the reason is – A, the general momentum, if you believe the insiders in the program, has been towards Tua for quite some time. If you believe the rumblings, there were people last year that were urging, including Brian Daboll, the offensive coordinator, who were urging Nick Saban to involve Tua more in the offense during the season. And ultimately, Saban didn't feel comfortable enough during the season to put a true freshman into those games, because there were some games that were a little bit tighter than they were expecting.
It also didn't help that the one long drive he had against meaningful competition, he threw a pick six for a touchdown.
Yep.
Exactly. And it was a as great as he looked against the scrubs of the world, that one pick six, I think, scared Saban off significantly because it looked like a size issue. It looked like he couldn't see over the opposition. And so they benched him and kept Jalen in. And that was one of the issues of Brian Daboll and Nick Saban, is that Daboll Daboll felt like the playbook was so limited with Jalen in at quarterback that he could not do the sort of NFL pro-style concepts he wanted to, because Tua Tagovailoa is a gifted passer to the level that Alabama has not seen in a long, long, long time. He is he has got a level of precision passing that I haven't seen at Alabama ever, I don't think. I mean, he's – and just some pure talent. A.J. McCarron's my favorite Alabama quarterback, probably will always be. But he never had the natural talent that Tua has. He never had the accuracy that Tua has. I think the fact that your playbook at Alabama can open up to such a degree if you have Tua in there, they'll be able to do things that they haven't done since McCarron was there in terms of not just your bubble screens – or your deep bombs, but opening up your intermediate passes, more complex patterns. As we saw in the national championship game, this is a young kid full of moxie, doesn't get down. If he makes a mistake, he comes – just like Jalen, by the way, who in his first game threw an interception on his first possession and came out and dominated the rest of the game. But Tua, he has that, but he also has the natural God-given arm talent. A level of precision accuracy you just don't commonly see. So I think he's going to be the 1A. I do think going to try to get involved to keep him happy. I don't think it's going to work, but I think that that's what they're going to try to do. I think that Tua is going to have growing pains. I think everybody is so hyped up. All the Alabama names are so hyped up over how Tua played in the championship game. We forget, A, about that pick six that Andrew mentioned. We also forget that he's extremely young, and when you're extremely young, it's easier to make mistakes with your arm than with your legs.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see that play out at times during the season.
There are so many parts to this. There's, number one, the fact that they've had all that turnover with their – and this is really my biggest fear with Alabama's program. It's not the talent, because the talent is coming in droves. And it's not even the quarterback position, because they won one with a guy named Jake Coker. But the thing is, the coordinator position, because it's such a premier spot to be in at Alabama, that when you are the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator at Alabama, that by nature makes you a hot prospect as a coach to be elsewhere. And that turnover where you went from Lane Kiffin to Steve Sarkisian for a game, and then Brian Daboll, and now Dable's gone, and you bring in
Mike Locksley,
who's like the passing game coordinator type of guy, and now he's running the offense.
It feels like when you used to play NCAA video games, that thing, and you'd get into like year four or five of your dynasty, and you'd be winning the national title every year, and every year your coordinators keep getting hired for head coaching jobs.
Exactly. And, you know, the defensive coordinator position now with Skur and then Jeremy.
Tosh Lapoy now.
Oh, my God. I am so worried about Alabama's – no, I'm not. But for the offensive side of the ball, yeah. You know, like, you worry about Jalen Hurts, and, yeah, the treatment is unfair, but the criticism does have a foundation to it.
Yes,
there was a point at the end of the year where Jalen Hurts is – I think it kind of started with the Mississippi State game, mm-hmm. where it felt like his game plan got really bottled up. Mm-hmm. Some people would even say the Clemson game, the national title game, but I wouldn't go that far. I would say it was more like late in the season when people kind of mm-hmm. figured out if you just kind of bottle up Hurts, and he's just going to try to tuck and run and tuck
Auburn,
and run.
Auburn, it really stood out in the Auburn game.
Yeah, that's Kevin Steele, who's kind of in that Todd Grantham blitzy type of package. Mm-hmm. So.
And the thing about Jalen is he regressed last year from what he was in his freshman year. His numbers regressed passing. He looked shell-shocked at times. He looked like he was afraid to pull the trigger. Part of that is not having him there.
I was about to say, it feels like the offense wasn't as suited to his strengths as it was under Lane Kiffin.
Well, because Lane this is not meant as a criticism at Jalen, because I like him a lot, but let's face it, we saw it with three quarterbacks in a row that were medium talent. two quarterbacks that were medium talent, who I think is talented in a different way. Lane Kiffin would literally signal the plays in from the sidelines. And last year, they tried to move away from that intentionally to try to develop Jalen into more of an on-the-field kind of intuitive feel-the-game player.
Yeah. Lane was more of an orchestrator. Everybody remembers the moment where Amari Cooper got loose on a touchdown, and he literally like put his hands up knowing he had a touchdown. Right. That's just the kind of like offensive
turned Blake Sims into an all-conference quarterback.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to like pump up much because there was disagreements between him and Saban too. But the thing is too that with Tua, like, it was one game. I'm not trying to make it like, oh, it was a fluke. He just had that one. It's like, it's not a DiVincenzo kind of thing. And, like, maybe he is good, you know. But then I hearken back to JT Barrett, Cardale Jones. You don't want a situation like that, which happened the following year, because the quarterback quote-unquote controversy wound up being one of those ones where two people did not implement each other. Now, have a situation like – let me give you one. Penn State, you've got Trace McSorley, but you got a guy behind him named Tommy Stevens, and he's really good. He's a running quarterback. Those two kind of complement each other because they're different. Is Alabama's offense and their offensive mindset sophisticated enough that they can complement the two? The thing that makes me laugh about Alabama and the quote-unquote quarterback controversy is that you're burying the lead, because the reason why they're going to win is the same reason about always wins, and that's the defense.
Defense and running game, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But before I move on away from the quarterback situation, I do want to touch briefly on the offensive coordinator situation. I'm not nuts about Mike Locksley as a play caller. His history is not very strong as a play caller. He was a play caller at Maryland for a couple years. He was the play caller at Illinois for a couple years. Not exactly teams you think of as offensive journeys. But here's why he's the offensive coordinator at Alabama. He is one of the greatest recruiters in the history of college football. And the word that got out last year was that Locksley was going to leave if he wasn't promoted. And so that's why he promoted. He was actually technically a co-offensive coordinator last year, by the way, alongside Brian Daboll, who was the main play caller.
He was kind of in the same position Sarkisian was in.
Right.
When Lane Kiffin was there.
And Locksley's a guy, they believed his recruit was important enough to keep him, and they rewarded him with the offensive coordinator position. Now, they also mitigated things a bit by bringing in Josh Gattis from Penn State to come in and help with the offensive system, who the players love, and particularly Dan Enos, who has been at Arkansas a few years.
Yeah, he was – I think he coached at Central Michigan for a while, right?
He did,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and then he went to Arkansas – and had a little run there with plenty of play calling experience. So I think they're going to try to mix some things up. The receiving core is amazing, as we saw in the national championship game. They were true freshmen last year. They're going to be sophomores this year. Talking about Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs, and
still apply for a red shirt and be granted an additional year of eligibility. And I have heard one of the scenarios I've heard thrown out there regarding Jalen is this is all. He's also going to graduate early.
Yes, he's graduating in December.
Right. So if he were to only play in four games this year, he is then able to transfer anywhere in the country without having to sit out. And if he redshirts, that means he has 2 years of eligibility left to play anywhere he wants.
And, yeah, I don't know that they're going to do that, but I think that, you know, to be honest with you, I hope that does happen. I hope that they get up enough in games that they can put in Mac Jones, the third stringer, instead of Jalen a few times. On the roster, and then he deserves that, in my opinion. He deserves that opportunity if Tua beats him out, which we don't know yet. But if Tua beats him out, he deserves the opportunity to go play somewhere else. I mean, he's graduating in 3 years. Awesome. And not even three full years, but in December.
That might be the only time you see a Matt Jones on television this year.
So,
except in the South, where it's totally okay.
So you know, I hope that happens for sake, because I want on the team. I think, like I've told you, Nick, it's a problem, and it could. I've seen it derail programs. We saw it a few times under Spurrier. We saw it with Urban with the Cardale Jones situation. It can derail championship teams. But at the same time, man, you got to have a good backup quarterback, and Tua can run too. But Tua is also a little bit smaller, and so Tua. he may get hurt. You know, he's coming off an injury in the spring, actually, that put him out of the spring game. So we'll see how that plays out. Now, what I'm not concerned about is position talent, which has been there for years.
And I was going to mention that, like, the thing that was so impressive in that national championship game, it's, I don't want to call it an act of desperation. I would be almost, like, right on the edge of calling it then the second half. But it felt like Nick almost, like, emptied the cupboard or, you know, or he threw the kitchen sink. He said, okay, I'm just, if the guys that have been starting for me who like lost the game for me against Auburn, if they're sort of not feeling it in the second half of this game when I need to win the national title, I'm going to throw in Jerry Jeudy. I'm going to throw in Najee Harris.
I was about to.
I'm gonna throw every five-star fucking recruit you've ever seen on in the whole wide world of sports, and I'm gonna throw them at you with no game plan and see if you can survive it.
I was about to bring up Najee Harris because I heard a stat on SiriusXM, which I wasn't aware of until just the other day, but Najee Harris' first carry in that game comes with, I believe, something like 12 minutes and 15 seconds left in the quarter, and he winds up being Alabama's leading rusher in the game.
Yep. Yeah, so the running backs, Alabama has been, with respect, Georgia's right there. Alabama has been running back you for so long now, they just churn them out one after another after another. I looked last year at that depth chart and I said, that is going to be the best running back depth chart in terms of like one through four that I think we see in college football for some time, because I think all of them are going to have jobs in the NFL.
Damian Harris coming back was huge.
And Damian Harris, and that shocked everyone. Nobody thought that was happening. Everybody thought Najee would be the starter this year with Josh Jacobs as the spellback, and then Brian Robinson, who was the fifth string back last year. Brian Robinson was awesome. And looked as yards per carry. I got to look at the numbers, but he might have been the best yards per carry back on the team last year. He's back this year as the fourth string guy. And so you're going to have Damian Harris, who was the all-purpose yardage leader for them last year. You're going to have Josh Jacobs, who's kind of like a gadget guy. They use him a little bit like they used Kenyon Drake, not as fast as Kenyon Drake, but a little bit of Mr. Everything. Mm-hmm. Then you got Najee Harris, who is everybody thinks is going to be the next Derrick Henry at Alabama. And so the running back fine, the wide receivers are fine. I think the big key that is going to help to if you watch that national championship game and the Clemson game before it and the Auburn game before it, watch Calvin Ridley's body language games and how increasingly frustrated he gets with Jalen. And the fact that they have plays set up, bubble screens, short in and out patterns. And the only key to that is the pass has to be on time. And instead, it's maybe just a half yard behind him, and he has to turn, stop, spin around, and try to grab the ball. And it totally disrupts the momentum. In the national championship game, Tua comes in, hits those screen passes in stride, and suddenly your running backs are getting off to 10, 15-yard plays instead of 10-yard plays.
You worry, though, that they do – I know they have skill position players, you know, just sitting on the bench ready to – but you do worry about them losing Ridley. Robert Foster never really, like, amounted to what people thought, but he was still a pretty good fast player. The one thing you have to worry about Alabama, because it's the scourge of their existence, is the kicking game.
That's what I was going to bring up. So, I was going to refer to it as the.
You also lose a great punter in J.K. Scott, great one.
Punter
is
a bigger loss than kicker.
Yes.
Here's the thing with kicker. They've actually – well, stop me if you've heard this before. They think they've actually found one. a year ago they recruited this kid and thought he was going to be the hot shot kicker, referring to Joss. They had to redshirt him because he showed up to camp and turns out he couldn't make a field goal, which is, you know, an issue if you're a kicker. So they had to say, who also couldn't make field goals with consistency, but they had to do what they had to do. Here's the difference this year. Alabama went out, and this is going to blow people's minds because we're talking about the best college football head coach, arguably, of all time. Alabama, until this upcoming season, has never had a coach work with their kickers. I guarantee that I'm probably the only person on this podcast that knew this, but in the past, Alabama special teams coordinator, straight from J.K. Scott, by the way, who revealed this in an interview in the offseason, he never had a one-on-one coach at Alabama. Nobody ever gave him technical advice on his punts. Nobody ever worked with him on – because special teams coordinators were usually just the generic like football coach guys. They weren't kicking gurus. That's why they would send their kickers and their punters to summer camps and then it just expect that to work. And it works for the punters, but as we all know – Nick, I know you know this as well as I do from our following in college and the NFL. Kickers are a strange sort, and they need somebody there to be a guru to them during the season. So they went out and they went to Texas A&M and they brought in Jeff Banks as their new special coordinator. And he was considered something of a wunderkind with his work that he did at Texas A&M. And from what I've read in the reporting going into camp is the Skylar DeLong, the rookie punter, and then Bulovas, the kicker, have both shown great improvements because they finally have somebody advising them on technical things that they're doing wrong with their kicking. So I think, knock on wood, because I'm wrong about this every year and I'm always nervous about it, but I feel like this might be the year where the kicking game turns around. And we haven't even got to the defense yet. I don't want to ramble.
Yeah, I don't want to talk too much about the defensive players because all of them will be drafted in the first or second
round. Yeah, I mean, like, it's
– out a little bit. But I'll just let Greg kind of round off some of the names for himself because I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about these things in the next, like, thoughts.
Yeah, so three returning starters from last year. That would be concerning for most teams. I'm not that concerned about that, honestly, because we've seen it before. But it is a low number. I mean, it's a low number to bring back. Isaiah Bugs, Raekwon Davis, and who was the other one that was the returning starter?
Anthony Jennings.
Jennings, yep. Jennings is back. So here's the other thing. Terrell Lewis blows out his ACL in the spring. So you're right back down to your same depth problems they had back last year. But – Alabama depth problems, I know, are not the same as other teams' depth problems, but you've got great starters, and you hope that you've got these unproven guys on the bench that have kind of, some of them have underperformed. Chris Allen has underperformed since he got to campus and hasn't been able to win a starting job. But you're going to have Dylan Moses, who I think everybody's excited about, 5-star middle linebacker. Mac Wilson, 4- or 5-star guy who was awesome last year. Everyone's excited about them. You're going to see a lot of Jamie Mosley this year. You're going to see him getting some action. Joshua McMillan. You're going to see up front Isaiah Bugs, Quinnen Williams, Raekwon Davis. Brian Ray is a guy who's a true sophomore that's going to get a lot of play.
Brian Ray was a nightmare in the LSU game.
Yep. The guy that I'm excited to see is Quinnen Williams. He was a monster against Clemson and made some plays against Georgia as well. But they're moving him to interior because they want to find a way to get him and Davis on the field. So he's going to be playing inside this year primarily. They're replacing virtually the entire secondary. So you're going to have some combination of Shaheem Carter and Diggs and on the outside, along with Savion Smith, who I think you know pretty well, Andrew, former
LSU.
He's
a transfer from LSU, yes.
Yep.
Trader.
He'll be starting on one side of the field, and then Trayvon Diggs and Shaheem Carter will be battling for the other side. Well, actually, the other thing is a guy that I'm familiar with, Patrick Surtain Jr., who was the prize recruit of the offseason for this great recruiting class, but he was their most touted recruit in the offseason. He is going to, I think, compete for a starting job on day one. He's the son, of course, of Miami Dolphins legend Patrick Surtain. Mm-hmm. And then at safety is a concern for me. Deontay Thompson has some experience. Redshirt junior. Xavier McKinney is going to get some time there. But from what I've read, that's the biggest position of concern in the secondary is figuring out who's going to be the quarterback back there of the secondary. They got to get that figured out. But, I mean, this list of talent, to your point, Andrew, is incredible, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's still there.
So, with all that being said, who do you fear? Who do you look at as being the top contender to Alabama?
I think the easy answer is Auburn. The beat, I mean, last year, straight up, won the game, played better that day. I think Mississippi State very nearly beat Alabama last year. That was actually a really close game. I think this year is in Tuscaloosa. Am I mistaken on that? No, I'm right on that. It's in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah.
And so, and then of course you look at the LSU game, which LSU always plays Alabama tough, always shows up. And it always
it's always a dogfight.
Oh, dogfight. Last year, quite frankly, 2 years in a row, Jalen Hurts won that game for Alabama with his legs when the offense was just stagnant. So I think LSU and Auburn is the safe picks, but those are the two teams that stand out to me as the biggest threats, with Mississippi State maybe on the side as another team that could give Alabama some problems.
I'm going to be – I don't know how hot of a take this is, because I think everybody believes that Mississippi State is going to be good. I think they're going to be really good, honestly. They bring back a lot of talent, of course led by Nick Fitzgerald. And I know you got the Joe Moorhead transition taking over for Dan Mullen, but conceptually the stuff he was doing at Penn State – is stuff I think naturally benefit Nick Fitzgerald very well and could lead to that team taking another step forward. I think they could be a 9 or 10 win team this year.
I agree. And you know, Mississippi State, I'm not going to say that they're going to play a different style, but I'll give you a basketball reference. Bill Self built a really good Illinois team with Darren Williams and Dee Brown and a couple of other guards. He left for Kansas, and Bruce Weber came in. Now, I'm not saying Weber is Joe Moorhead, but what happened is Bruce Weber put in a different style with a pretty good crop of talent, and by seeing it differently, they got more out of that particular group, and they almost won the national championship. I can kind of see the same thing with Joe Moorhead coming in, because Dan Mullen, like we talked about in Florida, he has a very specific style. He loves to run the ball. He likes a running quarterback. He wants a big offensive line. He wants to win with defense. But here's the kicker. They still have guys coming back. They have 9 starters on offense back and 8 starters on defense back. And then you bring in Moorhead, who's an offensive guru in that you know, frame of mind at Penn State. And now you add that in. That might actually just put him over the top, maybe for just a year.
Right.
You know, and then they kind of fall back to earth.
Right.
But, I mean, we played them LSU played them in last year, and they kicked our ass. And the reason they kicked our ass is because their defense was really good. We could not move the ball.
Yeah.
And their defense really good. Alabama can attest to that because they played them. You know, and that's all there. And Nick Fitzgerald, yes, he broke his leg. But I'll tell you what, his backup, Keaton Thompson, is not bad either. You know?
I think at the end of the year, when you look at the records, Auburn has more talent probably, but I think they play a tougher schedule. I think at the end of the year, we're going to be looking at Mississippi State as the third best team in the SEC behind Alabama and Georgia.
The thing that fascinates me about Auburn is that this is the first time to my memory that Gus Malzahn has an offense where he has to throw the ball.
Yes.
That's the strength. And, you know, Aaron Murray, they did it in Georgia where, you know, listen, if that's your strength, go for it. Alabama even did it. They fell in love with the deep ball because Amari Cooper was their best. You would be a damn fool not to throw him the ball. And with Auburn, they don't have it at receiver, but when you have a guy like Jarrett Stidham, and he made the strides that he made, and you got a lot of good receivers coming back. I know they lost Will Hastings as well, but like mostly receivers where it's at, you know. And they're going to want to run the ball because it's Gus ball, but they're going to throw the ball a lot at Auburn. It's going to be a different style.
And they're going to they lose Kerryon Johnson, who, you know, saw what that offense looked like against Georgia when Kerryon wasn't healthy.
Yeah,
and take Martin him off the team early. I think that makes a big difference.
Yes.
I think Cam Martin's good, though. I think you're underselling him a little bit. He was very small and undersized last year. I think he'll be a bit.
He's still good. They told Cameron Petway to take a hike.
Yeah. I think Gus is going to have to make adjustments this year from what he likes to do, which is, as you guys know, he ran Kerryon Johnson into the ground. He ran Petway into the ground. He ran the guy before him whose name I forgot that kind of flamed out in the NFL, into the ground.
Mason, yeah.
Ran him into the ground. That's what he likes to do, is take one back and just
pound him.
Pound him to a ridiculous.
Help me out here. The one who now plays for the Carolina Panthers.
Peyton Barber?
No. Well, Peyton Barber was one of them too, but the one before him, I forget it.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
He's a three-name guy. But he did it to them too. After
Artist Payne,
Cameron Artist Payne. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he did it to them too. You know, yeah. Really killed them in the SEC title game because they beat Alabama. Super emotional game. Put everything in it. Jarrett Stidham was great. They go play Georgia in a game after they had whooped Georgia in the regular season. Auburn. They go to the SEC title game. They looked wasted. They looked like they had nothing left. And Georgia,
they exhausted their entire playbook in the Alabama game. I mean, yeah. they threw everything but the kitchen sink in that game. But the thing is, I've got to have, as much as I hope that I'm wrong, but my way, Auburn would be finishing just below Arkansas as the worst team in the SEC. But I think Auburn is still going to be the number two team. I think LSU also, because LSU's A, they're going to play Alabama tough and have a shot at winning, even if they don't. They're going to have a good defense. They always do. I don't know about that offense. I can't get a grasp on what he wants to do with their offense. But Mississippi State, to me, I don't know. I feel about Mississippi State, Nick, the way that you feel about South Carolina. I feel it's a lot of hype over an unsure situation. We don't know how the quarterback's going to bounce back. They don't have a lot of depth. And installing a first-time head coach – it could be to what Andrew's point is. Maybe this will be that missing ingredient that spikes them for a year. I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to say Auburn edges them out, and I think LSU edges them out too.
Yeah, and for Mississippi State, you don't want to, it might be a repeat of last year where they look great against LSU, they go to Georgia, and they go to Auburn. Ass kicking. And they finished out strong, and they played well against Alabama despite losing, and they had a good record to finish, but it was sort of that tape measure type of scenario where you mm-hmm. think you're there, but you're not. And, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen to them. We talked about Kansas State, and they go there. But if they beat them, what does it really prove? You know, it proves that you're probably good, but not that great. And then you play Florida, which will be kind of interesting because of the Mullen thing. And then you play Auburn at home. Mm-hmm. And then you have a bye week, and you go to LSU. And now you really know how good you are.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think the thing I look at, though, is their schedule is a little bit easier than it was last year. You reference they had to go to Georgia last year. That's swapped out in terms of their rotational game for a home game against Florida. And probably a team that, you know, still in the month of September is going to be figuring things out in terms of who they are under Dan Mullen. And they have Auburn at home. And I think they have
Alabama on the road, though.
They do have Alabama on the road. Let me clarify. I'm not talking about them as a legitimate SEC West contender. I am talking about them as
right
in general.
I think they can finish second in the West, and I think that is their ceiling.
I think Auburn can finish top 10 and not win the West.
Yeah. I mean, that's very possible. I think the thing with Auburn is I think Washington game week one is huge for both teams involved. Yeah.
And I said I think they're in trouble. I do because of the style of play. I don't know if they'll be ready for it. And I'll also be so glad to see that bastard Daniel Carlson again making 50
yard. Oh my god! Field.
And let's not forget,
his brother's there now, right?
Yes.
Yeah, his name is Anders.
Yeah. the thing about Auburn's schedule you have to look at is now, you know, ever since Missouri and A&M came into the league and they had Georgia go to Auburn 2 years in a row, that changed Auburn's schedule rotation to where now in even-numbered years, Auburn has to finish their year at Georgia, at Alabama, 2 out of 3 weeks.
We had a hurricane mishap schedule-wise in Florida, so we got to go at the swamp again.
Right.
Yeah.
Since they've gone to that rotation of having to play both Georgia and Alabama on the road in the same year, Auburn has never won either of those games. Wow. Gus is 0-6, I believe.
How is it? By the way, this is a little fanboy complaint of mine. Alabama had the most prestigious – one of the most prestigious programs in college football history. Can't recruit a kicker. Auburn always recruits a kicker. Like, it just feels – and always a great one. It's incredible. I don't get it. But – that being said, what about Texas A&M? We haven't mentioned a thing about Jimbo.
And see, that was going to be my next point. Is I think we Auburn and Mississippi State to me are the two teams that are going to be battling it out for that number two spot in the West. And then behind them, you get two teams that I don't know what to make of them, and those are LSU and Texas A&M. Before we get to Texas A&M, Andrew, this is like the LSU team coming into this year. I could see them winning 9 or 10 games, and I could see them winning 6 games. Like, I really can't get a read on what LSU is.
Downward trend for the program, but It's just that same feeling of we got a really good defense. We never give up more than 20 points a game on average. We always seem to be physical and do all this stuff on the defensive end, bring in the talent, of course. And then offensively is where it's just over and over again. You bring in Matt Canada from Pitt because he runs the jet sweep, and you think you can install it and do this stuff. And it didn't do much. In fact, their offensive numbers last year were worse, this meeting, and almost got into a fight. And that's why Canada wound up being after the right before the bowl game. He basically said, "I'm getting out of here." And there was just a lot of strife there. They brought back in Steve Ensminger, who was actually a tight ends coach, but he was installed as the offensive coordinator. Bergeron, when Les Miles was fired, that's sort of his guy. But it's that sense of like nothing's going to change. The thing that's funny about the offense is there was all this like bullshit about how bad it was. If you actually look at the personnel, everybody in the backfield on offense got put in the NFL draft. Right. So you wonder, I mean, listen, Danny Etling, it's just one of those things. He's just one of those quarterbacks where his efficiency looks good, his completion yards per completion looked really good because they would throw bombs at DJ Chark and Russell Gage. But like, you just wonder how good he really is. And I never questioned how good Darius Geis was or how good DJ Chark was. I knew they were talented.
And I don't know from what I've heard that Joe Burrow is coming to ride the bench. Like,
he thinks he's got it ahead of Miles Brennan.
Right.
And Miles Brennan very much reminded me of, I'm not trying to compare him, but he reminded me of Tua, because he was one of those guys where you hear a lot. When you see him on the field, you get excited and you see some good things. And then you see a really, really bad interception and you're like, oh, don't worry about that. You know, so you sort of temper your expectations because you want to see Brennan. They have another guy, Lowell Narcisse, but he didn't really jump ahead in the spring either. So I wonder if it's going to be Burrow or it's going to be Brennan. And, you know, the problem is I don't really know how open Orgeron is about his practices. I remember Miles was renowned for being incredibly secretive about practices. No one even knew Leonard Fournette hurt his ankle until like halfway through his like junior year, and then it turned out he was like badly injured.
What's amazing is they're another team, though, like Alabama, like Georgia, that always has a stable of running backs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Every year. Every year they
this
have running backs that look better than the starter.
And they still get the good ones, but they still got a weaker crop this year than ever. I mean, it kind of reminds me of 2014 when they had Fournette as a freshman. Like, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Nick Brissett, who's been there forever. Like, I don't know how good they are. Here's the thing I want to say. I'm going to get away from the offense because I do think it's going to be a bit of a mess. Defensively, they lost a lot of guys like Greg Gilmore, Christian Locator, Dante Jackson, Oliver, who was okay. Arden Key just basically got fat, for lack of a better word. He was like a beast his freshman sophomore year, and he just kind of like stopped caring. You know, he actually spent the entire spring at home. He like didn't even go to school, and he just stopped working out. But anyways, they lose a lot of guys on defense, but they played a ton of freshmen. Like freshmen that you probably never even heard of, like guys like Jacob Phillips and, you know, Grant Delpit and Clavon Jason, like all has got some significant play behind guys like Dante Jackson. And then you bring in two really, really good, almost borderline All-American type of players. Devin White, who's just a tackling machine. He reminds me of Kevin Minner. And then you have Greedy Williams. A lot of people try to compare him to Tyrann Mathieu because of the number of interceptions and passes broken up he racks up. But he reminds me a little bit more of like Eric Reed. You know, not in terms of the hard hitting, but in terms of just need to make plays constantly, you know. Then you look at the schedule. You play Miami and Arlington to start. That's really tough.
Yeah, that,
you
yeah. The schedule is brutal, man. It's just
Brownie
brutal.
Against Southeastern, then you go to Auburn. Louisiana Tech with Skip Holtz there in Coosa, not a walk in the park. We haven't played Louisiana Tech in many years.
Mm-hmm.
So Ole Miss is always an interesting game. The Florida game is always a brawl. Always, always, always. Then you go back home and you play Georgia. And then you play Mississippi State. And then Alabama. And it gets really tough. I will say this. Say it kind of dwindles down to what you're saying. Like, say they're in 7-4. If you play Texas A&M, who we have beaten every single year, and you lose to them, it's curtains for Orgeron. That's just how I feel.
So 8 wins minimum, you think, John?
Yes. Yes. If they go 7-5, I think the Boo Birds will be coming out.
And the thing is, the schedule is so...
I think people in the quote-unquote board, or what do they call them, blue chips, the friends of the program? Like, the friends of the program will be coming out complaining about how Ed's... But they were complaining about how Ed had to go when they lost to Troy.
Yeah.
So, we'll see.
I mean, I think the schedule is so brutal that it's possible they could be a better team on the field than they were last year and still lose five games. Because, like...
Well,
like
they're definitely not good offensively, and their offensive numbers were not good at all. So, right. That's the scare, you know?
Yeah, it's tough to survive in a league where, according to Colin Cowherd, Nick Saban's on his last legs and Gus Malzahn run him out of the league. So it's hard to survive as a head coach.
Yeah, and Georgia almost ran Gus all the way to Arkansas.
Oh, God.
We'll see how that works. But, you know, listen, Dave Aranda, love him, but I know he's going to be gone next year. I mean, it's just a guarantee some big-time school is going to get him. Mm-hmm. It's just going to – and then when that happens, it just – You
look
can
out.
Forget about it. Yeah. Well, that's when it starts to get ugly.
Both you guys brought up Texas A&M. And real quick, you know, before we put a bow on this SEC discussion, what are we to make of him? Because they always recruited pretty well under Kevin Sumlin. And the cupboard is not as bare as I think a lot of people think it is.
Their defensive front is really good.
Yeah. And I think there's talent there. And Jimbo has that reputation as a quarterback guru. And – you know, the problem for them is they're going to play a stacked division, so there's kind of a ceiling on how good they can be. But I feel like they'll be more competitive in year one under Jimbo than a lot of people are thinking, I think is where I'm going. The problem for them is the damn schedule. Between the conference schedule and playing Clemson, man, it's a murderer's row for them. But I do think, especially if you pay attention to the way his second recruiting class is already shaping up right now, at Texas A&M, he is establishing himself as a team that's going to recruit in the top 10 to this point. He's shown that he's probably going to push Auburn for that number 3 spot in the conference in terms of recruiting, trying to get in that Alabama-Georgia recruiting battle a little bit and pushing to be that. So it's going to get very interesting the next few years with Jimbo and Saban and, you know, in the same division. I can't wait to see how that plays out.
Not only that, they spent big money just to get Jimbo, right, and then they spent a little even more to get those coordinators, and they got Mike Elko from Notre Dame to run the defense,
right,
and they got Darryl from Memphis to run the offense. That's
you know what? Bad. And you guys, what you said earlier, Andrew, about Mississippi State, maybe Moorhead coming in is that shot in the arm the program needs, even if it's just for a season. What if we see that here with Jimbo? What if what's needed was someone with Jimbo's mentality to come in and sort of rally the troops in that classic John Gruden with Tony Dungy's players kind of way? And maybe they're the team that we're all overlooking here.
I think it's possible. The only thing that really gives me major pause with them is I still have questions about the quarterback position. And yes, I know, like I just said, Jimbo is going to coach up a quarterback. But I wonder if they don't have that guy yet on the roster that you can really,
the team. On either side of the ball.
Right.
Now, like I talked about their defensive front, you know, Kinsley Kiki and Landis Durham, Tyrell Dodson, all very good players. You know, the thing is, like, I mean, none of them are Myles Garrett's, you know. And listen, your mileage may vary on Garrett. You know, a lot of people felt like him about him the same way about Clowney, that he's sort of like loafed it at the end. Mm-hmm. But that's a criticism of someone at A&M. A lot of people felt like firing some financially, A&M was sort of straddling themselves, but they were so desperate to be, you know, relevant that they just basically emptied the piggy bank to get Jimbo, and it worked. So you gotta see if it pays off on the field.
Awesome. All right, well, let's wrap up our SEC discussion as we have with the other ones. Guys, let's hear your game of the year in the SEC. I'm fully on the Mississippi State bandwagon. I'm saying Mississippi State at Alabama, November 10th, is your game of the year in the SEC.
Iron Bowl.
Of course you would say that. Andrew?
I would say the Iron Bowl. In terms of entertainment, I love the Egg Bowl. Or the is it the Egg Bowl or is it the
Egg Bowl is Ole Miss and Miss State.
I love that game. Mm-hmm. I really do. It's always
especially
kind of
now that it's back on Thanksgiving. Never should have left Thanksgiving, in my opinion.
Well, you know, Nick Fitzgerald broke his leg in the last Egg Bowl, but I mean, we didn't talk about him because we kind of running out of time. But Ole Miss ain't bad. You know, they offensively they're actually quite good.
The problem is that division's so stacked that like not it's probably still the sixth.
It's like,
you know,
it's like that lower card spot fest type of things. Like, I know they're not relevant, but God, they're fun.
Yeah,
you know, so, like they play in Houston. I am watching that game.
Oh, absolutely, you know? Absolutely. That's gonna be a hell of a fun game to watch. So yeah, you guys are going Iron Bowl. I'm going Mississippi State, Alabama, SEC Championship. I got Alabama over Georgia. What about you, Greg?
This is a hard one, and this is not just you're going to think that it's just me being nervous. But in this case, I think these two teams are so evenly matched and will be for years to come. Flip of the coin here. I'll take Georgia, but it could very easily be Alabama. They're very evenly matched, despite your scoffing, Nick.
The depth chart is not yet evenly matched. Alabama has more depth along both lines at this point. It was really arguably the major difference in the game.
The difference in a game that was decided in overtime.
It was,
by the way.
But Georgia's still not there yet, is what I'm saying in terms
they
of
very, in terms I of don't know. I think they're closer than you're giving them credit for.
It's close, but it's not there yet, is my point, and I think that's the difference. Andrew?
I was going to say Alabama beats Georgia where Riley Ridley turns on Georgia in favor of now evil Atlanta Falcon.
Yeah. He rips in, off and has an NWO Atlanta, shirt on.
Yeah. God. You know, the thing that – I'll say this. You know what? This will be my sort of hottest take because, you know, Alabama-Georgia is not – it's not exactly a hot plate of like wow, that's a really reach. I'll say that Alabama plays Georgia, but they play each other again about a month later.
And that's a great segue because we're going to move on to, and kind of wrapping up with a little bit of general national discussion. And Andrew, you just alluded to some playoff stuff, but before we get to that, let's. In the interest of time, give me the absolute one non-conference game that you're looking forward to. Mine, as I've alluded to in both the Pac-12 discussion and the SEC discussion, I think Washington Auburn on September 1st at the Georgia Dome is far and away the most important and impactful non-conference game as it relates to the college football playoff. That game is a virtual eliminator in terms of those two teams and their hopes to be included among the Final Four. Greg, what about you?
Oh boy, there's a lot of really good games out there, non-conference. Certainly, you could look at Notre Dame, who we talked about their schedule for a lot of those games. I'm going to take one that I think is going to be a very important game for two different conferences in the national. I'm going to take Ohio State and TCU.
Okay.
I believe that if TCU loses that game, write them off as a national contender, and I think if Ohio State loses that game, probably write them off as a national title contender.
All right. Andrew, what about you?
I'll split it with selfishly, LSU-Miami, because if Miami wins that, that's a huge momentum swing for them in that part of the ACC because they could try to build some stock from there. Michigan-Notre Dame is huge.
Yes.
Michigan-Notre Dame is huge because Notre Dame, we didn't talk about them because they're on the independent side. Maybe we can put a sidebar here. Notre Dame is actually really good next year or this year coming.
They are. Their schedule, even by Notre Dame standards, their schedule is
very hard.
Brutal this year, man. It's as tough as it's ever been.
But, Nick, we say that. Let's say Notre Dame goes 11-1.
They're in.
Might be enough. The other one, I think this is the group of five one, Boise State at Oklahoma State. Because if they get by that one, they're going to go undefeated.
Interesting. All right. And before we dive into our playoff contenders, I want to hear your Heisman Trophy winners. And I'm going to say it. While I don't know how good the team, I think this dude's going to put up monster numbers and have an opportunity to be in that Heisman contention. I'm going to go Will Grier at West Virginia as my Heisman Trophy winner.
Mackenzie Milton.
You think they'll give it to a UCF guy?
In lieu of stronger contenders at your national championship contending teams, yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, that was kind of a wild. If it's going to go to the best player on the best team, watch out for Damian Harris.
What about you, Andrew?
J.K. Dobbins at Ohio State because they're gonna run the ball if they don't trust the new guy. Khalil Tate at Arizona, like because you mentioned him. And there was one more I was thinking of.
I know we brought up Bryce Love earlier. All three of us were singing his praises.
Bryce Love is a no-brainer. That's just an easy one to forget in the Pac-12 after dark mess. I was just thinking of another one, and I wanted to say it was a Big 12 guy, but go ahead.
What about the and I'm forgetting his last name right now. He's not going to nobody ever does on that side of the ball. But what about the guy that might be the best player in college football this year, who is the defensive lineman for Houston?
Ed Oliver.
Ed Oliver.
You know, anyone coming out of the SEC this year, it would have to be someone who just, like, puts up – oh, that was the other one I was thinking of, Nick Fitzgerald at Mississippi State.
There you go.
Interesting.
Because if you look at – if you're going to use that top – player on the top team formula, and the reason why I see Dave Harris having a hard time is Alabama and Georgia both are so heavily running back by committee now, it's hard for those guys to get the numbers to work themselves into contention, because they're probably going to get 15 carries a game max, plus a couple of catches maybe. Yeah. I mean, you're not getting more than 20 touches in a game.
Yeah, the Derrick Henry thing was an outlier.
It really was. But, so
Well, let's be honest. Watson should have won 2 years in a row. And end of story. Lamar Jackson winning was a joke. Henry was a 50-50 situation. You know?
I believe Derek deserved that. I will go down saying he's the best Alabama running back of my lifetime.
We didn't talk about McSorley. McSorley, it really depends on where they go with him at quarterback now that they have a new guy coming in to replace Moorhead. I forget his name. Oh, Ricky Ronnie. So we'll see what happens.
That sounds like a NASCAR driver, by the way.
Name Ronnie.
Ricky Ronnie. That says nothing of Jim Bob Cooter in Detroit. But Andrew, you made reference earlier. You said Alabama and Georgia are playing twice this year. So let's dive.
I think Georgia could go undefeated, and then they lose that SEC championship game, but they still sneak in.
And that is the exact scenario I think is going to play out. So let's dive into our playoff picks. I'll start here, and I'm going to say my four. I've got Alabama at one, Clemson at two, Georgia at three, and Washington at four, which would give you Alabama, Washington, and Clemson, Georgia finals. I'm going to take a national title of Clemson, Alabama, Clemson, Alabama four, and I'm going to say Clemson evens the series at two and wins the national championship. Greg.
I'm genuinely shocked, Nick, because usually you try to troll me by just picking Alabama to win every game, every season. But
that's not true. I actually picked Clemson to win the national title 2 years ago when they won the national title. So there you are.
I will have it with Clemson at number one. We're at number two. Alabama at number wait a minute. Let me think here.
Because you would have to be relying on the committee to do an immediate don't think they would do.
Yeah. Okay. Penn State at number three. And Alabama at four.
Okay.
Then I have Clemson over Alabama. I have Georgia over Penn State. I have Clemson over Georgia.
Andrew.
Number one, I have Clemson. I don't think they'll lose. Two, I have Alabama. Three, I have Wisconsin. Four, I have Georgia because they lose the championship game, but they still get in.
Right.
Clemson plays Georgia, I would have to assume, in the Cotton Bowl. And then in the Orange Bowl, Alabama plays Wisconsin. Clemson would beat Georgia. Alabama would beat Wisconsin. We get Clemson, Alabama again, and Alabama.
Okay. There you go.
Three people on the panel, three different picks. I like it.
I will say this. Boise State will be the town crier on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I don't know why, I just get that feeling.
Yeah, I agree with that. Them or the Big Ten champ again, because I've got them.
Because of the UCF thing. Yeah. You know?
And I would say for mine would be as far as the big conference teams, I would have Oklahoma gave me because I think that if they're able to get even like 80% of what they got out of Baker Mayfield, they should run roughshod in the Big 12, in my opinion.
And if Stanford is a one-loss team, I would make the case for them. I would make the case.
I think what I'm basing mine off of is I think the Big Ten champ probably has two losses again. I just think that league is so full of parity, they're going to beat up on each other all over again. Well, and I think Oklahoma well could lose one or two games and not have a very impressive schedule.
And the problem with Wisconsin is the same thing the last 2 years. Sure, you're gonna build up some good rapport when you're getting there, but you got to win that Big Ten championship game. You know, that's
yep. Well, guys, it has been a ton of fun. The season is almost upon us. We are, as of this recording, 23 days away, thereabouts. And I, for one, cannot wait. I'll buy games. I'll be heading down your way, Andrew, in mid-October and looking forward
Bring me up.
To that. I absolutely will. We will be there in New Orleans on Thursday night before that game and then heading over to Baton Rouge on Friday. So looking forward to that. Guys, it has been a ton of fun. I look forward to talking hopefully with you guys again throughout the season here on the Place to Be Nation Sport Work. And with all that being said, we hope you have enjoyed this college football preview. We are looking forward to the season. Let us know your thoughts. Reach out to us on Twitter or via the Place to Be Nation Facebook page. Let us know the teams you're looking at. Well, you know, what picks we got absolutely wrong or what you think we're on the right track about. You can find me at NickDuke87 on Twitter. Greg is at GPhillips8652. Andrew, where can people hit you up on social media?
At Andrew Reich.
At Andrew Reich. And, of course, in just a couple months, you're back with the NBA team because we're going to be opening up camp here. What is that, beginning of October typically or end of September?
It's like late September. Sometimes they go to like the army places for Earth and they do somewhat right, training right. camps. But beginning of October is when preseason starts.
And I'm sure you guys will have a full slate when that gets ready to get going.
Oh, I can't wait for the Lonzo Ball era in LA.
And let me say, while we're on the same podcast and it's sports related, people don't realize it now because it's kind of a couple down years. Alabama and LSU, to me, it supplanted the Auburn rivalry for a few years as the most heated for a while of the rivalries for Alabama. Right there with Auburn was the LSU rivalry. Andrew and I have been on opposite sides of that rivalry since we've known each other for about, gosh, what's it been, maybe?
Yeah, we kind of became friends right when Saban left the Dolphins.
Right,
which is funny because you're a Dolphins fan.
Yeah, exactly. worked out, I guess. But we've known each other the whole time and have never had anything but a friendly relationship. So I really appreciate that because I know fans on both sides of this rivalry get a little rambunctious.
Well, and then for those that, I mean, obviously, if you've listened it all the way through, no, I mean, the hard-traveling fanboys were almost at a crossroads because they had to play each other for the national championship because of the playoff. We, as in Greg and I, we didn't need no stinking playoff. We just needed yes to fool everybody and play for the national championship.
Hey, I wish there hadn't been a playoff and then Alabama wouldn't even been in the damn thing.
even though in the dome, that was like probably the worst sports experience of my lifetime. So,
yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Sorry, man. It's one of those, but they were the two best teams, I think.
Oh, God. 2011 LSU is
Oklahoma State. I'm just kidding. I don't actually believe that.
Oklahoma State was awesome. That was the Justin Blackman team.
Yeah. They would have gotten their shit kicked in
by either one of those teams.
Yeah. And then Georgia the next year was really good, but they lost to Bama in the SEC title game. We'll see if that repeats itself.
Which is one of the best games I've ever seen in my life. So. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys. Well, it's been a ton of fun. We hope you guys have had as much fun listening to it as we have recording it. And stay tuned for more of the content we have coming up for you. I know I can go ahead and tell you, next week or thereabouts, maybe in the next couple of weeks, I will be back here on the Place to Be Nation Sports Network with an NFL preview. I'm out to the core Place to Be Nation contingent as I'm going to embrace Place to Be Nation's Northeastern bias as JT Rosero, Roger Morissette and Jay D'Amato will be on here with me to talk a little NFL preview. So I am very much looking forward to that. Until next time, guys, and we hope you are as excited about the impending season as we are.